You know, the fans were unbelievable today. You know, they were outstanding.
Fans were amazing. I mean, the energy in there. I mean, they were loud. Teddy came in the game, and you know, you could hear the whole fans go crazy, and you get goosebumps.
Teddy Bridgewater is walking onto the field.
I mean, it was awesome.
Again, winning the division is big.
The screen left for Latavius Murray with some room. To the 15, 20, 25, 30. Outside the numbers to the 40. And he's out of bounds at the 45. A big screen gain. Case Keenum to Latavius Murray for 31.
I really appreciate these players and the way that they work and the way they go about their business.
Murray at the goal strike to the end zone. Touchdown! To a 6-0 lead. Third and six from his own 23, play clock to one. They get it off. Dalton looks left. Intercepted! And it's intercepted! Eric Kendricks near side. 20-15-10. Touchdown! Eric Kendricks with a 30-yard pick six. 13-0.
We'll come in. We're hoping we never have to leave here again once we get rid of this next game.
The silence you hear is Lambeau Field.
Then we got another game at home, and we got one away next week, so we'll get a chance to have our last game and play them in front of our fans. But before we do that, we got a big one next week.
Snap spot. Horvath, right-footed kick. Up, up, and good! Kai Horvath with a 53-yard hit. Dalton Flutter, Dalton hit, Dalton sack. And the sack goes to Brian Robinson. And he's sacked! Second sack today for Brian Robinson, third on the season. 66,000 plus on its feet. Cincinnati 0-5 on third down. Dalton, play action. Here's Daniil. Hey, got it, Daniil.
It's the blood of a champion.
Get off and digs left. Two receivers right. Case five-step drop. Fires right. Man wide open. It's Jerick McKinnon at the 50. Center of the field 40. Bengals territory 30. And he stops at the 27. Like a jet. After he caught the ball, it's a 41-yard catch and run by Jerick McKinnon. And an explosive play for an explosive offense. Keenum passes to the end zone. Stephon Diggs extends the lead to 23-0. And it's intercepted by Terrence Newman. Yes! Terrence Newman just picked off a pass against his former team.
Yeah, I'm proud of this team, Greg. They, I thought they took good care of business today. We overcame some penalties, scored the first touchdown, getting an interception on defense, and put it in the house.
Yeah.
But, we did a nice job rushing the quarterback. We did a good job stopping the run.
We got goals, man. We got aspirations, so we're just going to keep working and keep grinding. It's
the final score, the Minnesota Vikings 34, Cincinnati 7. Pop the champagne and pass out the hats. The Minnesota Vikings are 2017 NFC North champions.
That's right. The Minnesota Vikings have a heart of a champion. They are NFC North champions for the second time in 3 years. Good afternoon. Brandon Molesky, 10 to B, in for the common man, Dan Cole, who is taking the entire week off, though he is actually here at the station today, working harder than I've ever seen him work when he actually is supposed to work. He's in the back room just signing hundreds, yes, hundreds of books, trying to get them out before Christmas for everyone that purchases book. But I'm in for the next 3 hours. Ryan Donaldson with me as well. And I know you created that montage. You put it together.
Yes.
I still think, even though you knew it was coming, you knew how it sounded, you'd probably heard it multiple times, you got more excited about that than anyone that's even listening right now.
No question.
Yeah.
Of course.
I mean, you're a huge Rube, and there's probably now going to be listeners saying, don't talk about being a champion, don't talk about how we can see our ring coming, because in Minnesota, that doesn't happen. You're jinxing the team now. I'm very confident in this team. And part of my confidence, not only just because of the performance of the team throughout the entire season, I don't think there's anyone great in the NFC. I think the two best teams are over in the AFC and the Patriots and the Steelers. We saw that yesterday.
Yes.
Now, does the NFC have much more depth? Yes. You know, really the Patriots and Steelers, they just have to beat each other and they're in. I mean, they're both getting to the AFC championship game. That's a foregone conclusion at this point. In the NFC, any of the six that get in, I think, could win it all. But I don't think there's a team that scares me. And with Carson Wentz now out, the Vikings might have the best all-around balanced team.
Can't really argue that right now.
Right? And I know we don't like to talk about it, and we can't say it here. And it's so bizarre, because every other NFC team or NFC championship team that I've seen, you know, 87, I was too young to really know what was going on that NFC championship game, but 98, greatest offense I've ever seen in my life, right? You thought you were going to win every game. 2000, not as confident, but you go, we got Randy Moss and Chris Carter and Dante Culpepper, right? We can win this game against the Giants. 2009, clearly you had a very sexy offense. One of the best running backs of all time, combined with one of the best quarterbacks of all time, even though he was up there in age, he could still sling it. Quality receivers, right? You had a legit offense. This team's never really had the sex appeal of all those other NFC championship teams, yet just based on how good their defense is. And let's face it, we've had enough sample size to know this is a good offense. I don't think they're elite. I don't think they're top five-ish, though stats-wise they might actually be somewhere up there. But they've got a strong line, even without Riley Reiff yesterday. They could still block.
Yeah.
Line solid. They're balanced. They can run. They can throw. They got a quarterback who can escape and improvise a little bit when you have some issues or have some breakdowns and extend plays, which we didn't really have here in the past couple of years. And now you look at, just got to get the home field advantage. Who's going to win in this place? Who's going to win at US Bank Stadium? Have you seen the Vikings record? Or the box scores of their games at US Bank Stadium this year? Game one, they beat the New Orleans Saints 29-19. Saints scored a garbage touchdown late. That was not as close as that score indicates.
Correct.
Right? Like we played the old pre-fend defense at the end. They come down. Get it to 10 makes that closer than it was. Now, I do recognize that New Orleans is a much different team now than we saw then. They didn't really have their running back identity yet. They weren't giving Kamara the ball as often. They had Adrian Peterson on the team. They probably still thought they were a passing team, and now they've kind of become more of a balanced team. So I know that's not the exact New Orleans Saints team that's put up the gaudy record all year. But that being said, you beat a team that's one of the best in the NFC handily at home. Beat the Tampa Bay Buccaneers 34-17. Another game that was not as close as that score indicates. Right? That was an absolute blowout. Tampa Bay got some garbage stuff at the end. The only game you've lost, and really all the games they've played they've won handily, was Detroit. And even in that game, I could go, you know, through the first half, the Vikings were the better team. And, you know, how are you going to predict Dalvin Cook's going to fumble the ball, snapping his leg, right? Or tearing out his ACL. So Detroit won, you give him credit. That was still kind of early in Keenum's tenure. He didn't really kind of have the confidence yet. The offense didn't have the confidence with him yet. That's the only flaw they have at home. And even that game, I thought the Vikings were the better team until Cook got hurt. And all of a sudden, you're going with running backs you haven't used all year. You gave him great field position on a fumble that you gave away. Beat the Packers 23-10. We all know what happened there. Probably would have been a completely different game if Aaron Rodgers was in, but he wasn't. There was never any doubt in that game the Vikings were going to win that game. Beat the Packers by 13. Baltimore, they win 24-16. Another game that was not as close as that score indicates. I think Baltimore got a touchdown late when it didn't matter. Vikings still win by 8, and I thought they I thought they took the foot off the gas a little bit in that game because they just knew their defense would be good enough to hold on. And they didn't want to make any mistakes. Beat the Rams 24-7. Now, that one out of all of them, I think that game was closer than the actual score indicated. Because that game was 7-7 going in the fourth quarter, and the Rams obviously had the chance late in the first half. Or was it Cooper Kupp that fumbled the ball at the one-yard line with a chance to give them the lead? Rams were a good opponent, and I think we've seen since we played them, that team's legit.
They're very legit.
They're really, really good. But that being said, you beat them by 17 at home at U.S. Bank Stadium. You took over in the fourth quarter. And then we saw yesterday 34-7. And the 7 doesn't really count because that's against our second team defense. We had all our backups reserves in. A very convincing win. Bad team. A team that was clearly beat up. And I even said to Chris Hockey after the Vikes go down first drive score, I said to Chris, I turn around and I go, you get this thing to double digits, Cincinnati is going to fold. Right? They just got killed by Chicago last week. They're playing for nothing. They're already beat up. Half their defense is out.
Their coach has one foot out the door.
There's rumors of their coach leaving earlier in the day. You get up double digits on them, and you could tell the second Kendrick scores, you know, the pick six, they kept showing shots of Cincinnati's bench. I mean, it's, what, halfway through the first quarter or late in first quarter? And their entire bench looked like this game's done.
Mm-hmm.
We're not coming back.
They knew they were
done.
It
was over already.
Yeah.
And I know it's a very simple, easy, predictable take to go, man, home field advantage is important. But with this team, it is. They're basically unbeatable at home. And it's going to take something weird, like a running back blowing out his ACL and fumbling the ball in your own territory to take this team down. And even if you don't get the one seed to Philadelphia holds on, I'm not as scared going to Philadelphia anymore with Carson Wentz gone. I know Foles put up 4 touchdowns yesterday. And their defense was a little shaky against Eli and the Giants. That was a little bit of a surprise. Out of all the teams, the Eagles scare me about the least. I'd be more worried about Carolina again, potentially Atlanta, New Orleans again, or even the Rams again than I would be Philadelphia. By that time, to me, you're going to have you get the first week bye. You should be playing a good quality opponent, but one that I think you can win at home. And I think the other team is probably going to knock off Philadelphia, and you can play 2 at home. So, very simple. Get that first round bye. Obviously, you advance another round, and it's like I said, it's the most obvious take ever to say how important home field advantage is. But,
sure.
But for this team, their defense looks unstoppable at home.
Yeah, I think our home field advantage might be greater than other teams' home field advantages. I mean, just look at the history. Look at the way the teams played at home defensively, especially. They gave up 7 points to the Rams that you mentioned earlier. That's a very legitimate offense that we're talking about. They just put up, what was it, 42 against Seattle yesterday?
Yeah.
Todd Gurley found the end zone 4
times.
And
Seattle's not the same defense, but still you're there with the 12s.
Right. You're on the road in Seattle, a place that used to be impossible to score. And they just destroyed the Seahawks defense. And this defense shut them down the entire game. It's been unbelievable. Yesterday was so loud you couldn't hear yourself think. My ears are still ringing. I mean, you heard the sound bites in my montage. The fans were the first things that the coach and Terrence Newman mentioned when talking to Greg Coleman after the game. The fans brought it, and the defense responded.
And the reason they brought it is because Mike Zimmer is a heck of a defensive coach. And that's what I want to talk about next, the reemergence of my confidence in Mike Zimmer. We'll discuss that next. Brandon Molesky in for Common.
It's the interim producer filling in as the interim host. You're listening to Brandon Molesky on The Fan.
Vikings win 34-7 yesterday at U.S. Bank Stadium. You heard it right here on The Fan. Brandon Molesky in for Common, Ryan Donaldson with me. And Ryan, a couple years ago, I don't know if it was after year one or year two of Mike Zimmer's tenure, I thought, this guy is a top 5 coach in the National Football League. Probably saved Rick Spielman his job. Because at the time, Spielman had gone through the whole Ponder thing, another losing or mediocre season or two. And I think Spielman might have been done. And at the time, I thought the best hire out of everything he's done, out of all the transactions he made, hiring Mike Zimmer was the best thing he could have done, because Zimmer, at least on the defensive side of the ball, I think, has the ability to coach up guys and make guys that are mediocre look good, and guys that are bad look mediocre, and guys that are good make them great. I think he does have that ability. I mean, you look at, you know, Xavier Rhodes 4 years ago, people thought was a bust. They were making fun of his holding penalties. He had to wear boxing gloves at practice.
Couldn't get an interception if his life depended on it.
He couldn't, and he was, you know, getting pass interference penalties all the time. And, you know, Trey Waynes, I think, not that Trey Waynes is some great cornerback, but Trey Waynes is a competent cornerback.
Right now he is, no question.
I mean, he's not getting beat very often. And he should be getting beat a lot more because they don't want to throw at Xavier Rhodes.
Right?
Even Sendejo.
I was going to say Sendejo.
Sendejo is he's a solid safety. I'm not going to act like he's all pro.
I thought he's had a really good year, though.
He has had a good year.
Really good year.
He's made some big plays.
He has.
He's been coached up. You know, Terrence Newman clearly has got Mike Zimmer's system down to a T and always knows where to be. You know, Everson Griffin has made a lot of progress.
Tom Johnson.
In his tenure. Yeah. You know, the linebackers kind of came out right away and were good, and Barr and Kendricks. But, you know, on the defensive side of the ball and the ability to confuse, you know, you've got guys that are going to get more sacks and more TFLs just based on the fact that Zimmer's putting them in the right spot and is coming up with schemes that confuses the opposing team, right? So just the stats are going to be better for all the individual players. And like I said, I thought the hire of Mike Zimmer was the best move Rick Spielman ever made, because it extended his career as GM of the Minnesota Vikings. Because up until that point, he had some massive issues. He was pretty hit and miss on a lot of his picks. And I thought, well, we've got a legit here, legit coach, legit top five coach here for the next X amount of years. Last year, for the first time, my opinion of that started to waver a bit. And I'm going, was I wrong on Zim? He sold me a bill of goods, and I thought I had him nailed down, right? It all started in preseason when he sat out Teddy in Seattle and didn't give an explanation as to why. He was really weird with Greg about just said coach's decision. So now everyone's speculating, you know, was Teddy late for a meeting? Did he, you know, commit a crime the night before? Is he injured? Right? Zimmer's being very coy and very secretive about it. And just for no reason, unnecessarily, and we come to find out he was fine until a couple weeks later when he got hurt in practice. But that was just a weird, awkward start to the season. But you're thinking, well, I can get over that, right? They get out to a 5-0 start. We had all forgotten about what happened with Teddy in the preseason. Well, not the other incident with Teddy, but the first one I was talking about. And then they lose two straight games, bad loss at Chicago, and Norv quits.
Right.
And you're thinking,
our pets' heads are falling off.
Yeah, what coach quits in the middle of a 5-2 season? I know they've lost two in a row. I know the offense is sputtering and looked terrible. And they really were 5-0 based on their defense and special teams up until that point. But you're thinking, is there something dysfunctional going on with this coaching staff and he's the head guy? Does Norv not like him? Can other coaches not get along with Zim? Right? That was bizarre. We know what happened then. The season really kind of tailspin from that point on. And then you get in December and you have a game at Lambeau Field in which your odds of getting to the playoffs were slim at that point, but you still had a mathematical chance of getting into the postseason. You still had something to play for. And apparently guys in the secondary are going against Mike Zimmer's game plan, and who, you know, it's supposed to be Xavier's covering Jordy Nelson one-on-one, but they've decided just to, on their own, but going against their coach, to just stay on their side of the field. And one of the guys was Terrence Newman, who's always been a Zimmer guy and came here because of Zimmer. At that point, I'm going, these guys just don't have the respect for Mike Zimmer I thought they did. And even throughout the season, I thought Mike Zimmer, and I'm just saying what I'm hearing, watching press conferences and listening to press conferences and post-game stuff, I thought he had gotten to the point where he changed his personality as a coach, too. He was always a guy that was very hard on his players. You need to do this to make me happy. And I thought he got soft, where even when they were losing badly, he'd make excuses and try to look at the bright side of things, and which is fine. There are some coaches that's the right way to go. For Zimmer, that just didn't seem his style. I just thought he was completely out of character. And after the Green Bay thing, I think Zimmer might not last next year, right? If the players aren't listening to him, if he's lost the locker room, I don't know if Zimmer and Spielman are going to make it through the next season. And clearly, everything that's happened this year completely changes your mind and goes back to where you were 2 years ago with Zimmer, does it not?
If not better than it was 2 years ago. I mean, look at the adversity this team's had. I mean, obviously, you had the Teddy Bridgewater situation. You got Bradford coming in this year. He goes down after week one. The phantom knee injury that no one really ever saw on the football field, but it
that whole
cost
thing was
them
still,
the entire season.
That whole
season.
Thing was still weird.
It was so weird. And then all of a sudden you get Case Keenum, this guy that you just picked up off the street for a couple million dollars, comes in, and he's in the MVP race in the NFL in week 16. The job he's done has been crazy, given all the adversity, too.
Yeah, and speaking of coaching up, I don't know how much credit to give offensive players for being coached up to Mike Zimmer, because he's always been just a defensive guy, and clearly Pat Shurmur has had a huge impact on this offense. Whether the credit goes to Zimmer or not, or whether the credit goes to Shurmur or Stefanski, the quarterback coach, that being said, Zimmer's the one who brought these guys in and identified these coaches as guys I want on my offensive end of the ball. Case Keenum clearly has been coached up. He looks better than he's ever looked anywhere else, and it's not even close. How about Adam Thielen, the progress he's made? 2 years ago, I thought, why is this guy even on the roster? And now he's going to be a Pro Bowler this year. I know you made some changes in personnel on your offensive line, but you're clearly getting more out of your offensive line, immensely more than you have in the past. Whether that all goes to Zimmer or not, I don't know, but you've seen improvements out of individual players on the offensive side of the ball. And like I said, even if that's not Zimmer's improvement, he hired the coaches and identified the coaches that have been able to do it. And I forgot about the Fat Cats Got Slaughtered thing last year, too.
I was going to bring that up. I didn't want to interrupt you.
I forgot about that whole thing, which was...
Even though Zim said that wasn't on him, I think that there were some rumblings that it was.
Well, it was his idea to put the Fat Cats out there, but in terms of them getting sliced off, we never got the full story of it.
Right. It's very controversial.
We never got the information. And then, what's been the other knock on Mike Zimmer? I'll throw it to you. In the past, what's been the knock on Mike Zimmer?
Oh, man, tough, like he's just too tough, on guys.
Well,
like he doesn't,
and he would even admit this. He's admitted this in the past.
Okay,
his ability in like game situations with the last 2 minutes of a game,
sure.
Managing the clock
management,
when to call a timeout. Right, they had multiple issues with that last year. They had it against Detroit at home, which ended up being a massive loss for that team last season.
Right,
which they score with 28-29 seconds left, and. Because he called the timeout early and gave Detroit just enough time to come back down on a miracle the other way. Now, the Vikings haven't been in a whole lot of close situations in the last 2 minutes, I guess, at Carolina last week. But all the whole clock management, there hasn't been a lot of decisions where Zimmer's been criticized for this year. Why did you challenge that? Why'd you call a timeout here? Why didn't you call a timeout? Why are we calling this play? None of that has occurred at all. And, when you're winning and you're 11-3, there's less to criticize. But that was a part that he would openly talk about in the past and would say, hey, I need to study up on this, these type of game situations, and get better at. And the evidence would show you that he has improved in that area.
And I think in the offseason, I remember him flirting with the idea of giving George Edwards, defensive coordinator, the defensive play call of duty, so he could be more involved in the overall game, in the offense, in the clock management, in the actual coaching duties, in the game, rather than being so worried about defensive play calls. Now, I don't know if he actually ever handed over those play call duties. I'm pretty sure Zim still calls them.
I don't think he did,
But I think, at least the fact that he
Even
was acknowledging...
if he did, we'll never know.
Well, yeah, there is also that. But the fact that he's acknowledging, hey, I got to get better in this area, so maybe I'll relieve myself of some responsibilities here to get better there... I mean, that tells you a lot.
And there's a lot of head coaches that have egos.
Right.
And that's difficult for them to admit that.
Correct.
And that's a guy who secured himself. And clearly he made improvements in terms of his relationships with his players off of last year as well. The Vikings are NFC North champions. The Green Bay Packers are not. The Green Bay Packers could be eliminated from playoff contention as soon as tonight if Atlanta can take down Tampa Bay. I wonder what the fans of the Green Bay Packers had to say after yesterday's game. We'll play that next. Plus, Brody from Chaska called into the Packers Wine Line show. So we will play that as well. Brandon Molesky in for Common.
It's Tenna B in for Common on The Fan.
right, welcome back. Brandon Molesky in for Common. Ryan Donaldson with me. Five questions about 20 minutes from now. Michael Russo of The Athletic will join about an hour from now to talk about the Wild's 0-point weekend in two games. And, of course, we have the Mike Zimmer press conference at 2 o'clock today. But now, maybe my favorite segment on the Common Man program.
Green and gold grieving.
Second down and goal from the 7. Bunches in short motion for the right. Newton takes the snap. He's back to throw. He fires over the middle. Caught by McCaffrey, and he takes it in for a Carolina touchdown. A 7-yard touchdown throw. Cam Newton hitting Christian McCaffrey. And the Panthers have the early 6-0 lead with 5:57 to go in the first.
It pains my heart so much to cry to y'all, even though we're all grown men here. The season was over basically when Rodgers got hurt. I mean, let's be honest. This whole... When Rodgers comes back, we can run the table. That was kind of fun to think about. But it's been a weird year, and I don't think any of us really thought that we were going to actually do anything with this defense not being as good.
Newton has the snap. He's back against the four-man rush. He throws up his back foot down the field. Got Olsen wide open. Makes the catch. Turns and strolls into the end zone. Touchdown, Carolina. A 30-yard pass play from Cam Newton to a wide-open Greg Olsen. Turned his back, made the catch at about the 2, and took a couple of easy steps across the goal line.
Delicious! But Rodgers basically had to be perfect today for us to even have a chance to win. And him underthrowing people and kind of getting happy feet in the pocket when it started to collapse, that's not gonna do well for us.
Rodgers waits on the shotgun snap with a play clock at 9. He's got a low snap. He's back to throw. He fires down the middle of the field, and it's intercepted. Coming back to the 40. Far side numbers 35. Inside the 30-yard line, Colin Jones picked it off.
What's going on with this defense? I mean, we're going on 10 years now, and it seems to be the same problem. And then you go on, and everybody picks on Colin Cowherd about how Aaron Rodgers, you know, could take a step. Would I blame him? No. I wouldn't at this point. He's got no help. We're going on 10 years. 10.
Well, I think you're going to get some hope in this offseason, Ralph. I think there's going to be some changes made.
Well, I'm just saying, Bill, 10 years. 10 years we're going on the same problem. 10.
Newton takes the snap. He's back on a play fake. He looks to his right. He pumps. He scans back left. He's got time. He throws back in the end zone, and it is incomplete. Damir Byrd was the receiver in the back of the end zone. He came down with his feet in bounds, but then appeared to bobble the ball momentarily.
After review, the runner was down by contact in the end zone. It is a touchdown.
So they gave it to him.
But the main thing is Pat Townsend, Mike McCarthy, they didn't do enough. They've been drafting on the defensive side of the ball. How much? I guess at what point in time does Mark Murphy hold Ted Thompson accountable?
Rodgers back, pocket collapsing. Rodgers steps up, looking down the field, throws deep down the field for Jordy Nelson, and it is intercepted again by Carolina. James Bradberry comes down with this one at the Green Bay 26. The third interception thrown by Rodgers today. And the Panthers, with a 10-point lead, will take over.
We got guys jumping off sides and making mental mistakes, and that's on coaching. And I think McCarthy's got to look at that and decide, does this staff need to move on? I'd hate to be a defensive coach in the meeting room this week. With that in mind, and then with the future, we got to get some players that fit the defensive scheme that we've got, because we just don't seem to have the players that can bring it home right now. It's just not getting done.
Newton in the shotgun with McCaffrey to his left. Newton has the snap, fakes to McCaffrey, looks, fires, end zone, caught, touchdown Panthers. The second of the game for Damier Bird. And Carolina has taken a 30-17 lead, 12:24 to go, 13 yards from Newton to Damier Bird.
I don't know, man. I just think this was a bad game for Aaron Rodgers. I think he's probably a little rusty, you know.
Yeah.
No doubt. He'll be back in form. Unfortunately, this was the wrong game for him to be rusty.
Delicious.
Rodgers, Cobb, and Nelson go to the left. Geronimo Allison out wide to the right. Jamal Williams is the back to the right of Rodgers. Here's a low snap. Rodgers back. Blitz coming. Throws on the slant right side. Caught by Allison. He's hit. The ball came out. There's a fight for it. It looks like Carolina is on top of it. The officials coming in to take a look. It's Panthers football.
Delicious.
I think, you know, the play calling where they totally abandoned the running game after it seemed to be, you know, starting up a little bit, keeping the defense on their toes, and then all of a sudden the second half it was totally gone.
Delicious.
All right, finally, that's it. It was a little longer than usual because there's so many negative highlights.
So much deliciousness.
So many negative calls that we had, you know, for the first time ever in the history of Green and Gold Grieving, we had to go to a second loop of the song. But I felt like the listeners needed to hear all of it. I didn't want to cut them short. So that was absolutely
delicious.
But we're not done.
Is that right?
And by the way, the highlights were from courtesy of Westwood One. The Green and Gold post-game show is on 105.7, The Fan. But you're thinking, well, now we're done with that part of the segment. Well, I received some tips via email and via Twitter from a couple people that I eventually probably would have found out myself anyway, because I go and listen to all the calls and then put them in the system. So I would have figured it out on my own anyway, but received some tips that a frequent caller to the Common Man program, Brody from Chaska, decided to call in to the Green and Gold post-game show, and here's how it sounded.
Let's get back to the phone calls. Talk to Brody listening to us in lacrosse. Brody, how are we looking? What's going on?
Hello?
Yeah. Hello, Brody, go ahead.
Yeah. I just can't help after watching the game feel sad for what's going on right now. You know, we've had all this success and stuff, and now you look at Aaron and he just looks sad, and it kind of makes me sad. And I kind of feel like that's affecting his play. Is that what you guys think?
That because he's sad?
Because, well, I mean, he trying to come back and trying to lead that team and didn't look good doing it. So yeah, he's probably not in the best of moods right now. Had they come back and won that ball game, I think that would have been a confidence builder and a huge uplift, because then they're still viable. They still played. They played poorly and would have gotten a win. But yeah, he didn't come back and do. He had, put it this way. Appreciate the phone call. You bring up a great point. Should Aaron Rodgers be sad? You know what? The guy hurried back so he could try to play and try to salvage the season. So no, I don't fault him in that area. But the pressure on Aaron Rodgers. We talked about this week. What happens if he plays well and they lose? What happens if he plays poorly and they lose? Because he had all of the hopes and expectations of Packers Nation riding on that arm today. You know?
Well, I was, you know, I was okay with it. It was a long shot.
I was too.
It was a long shot, Bill, that he didn't play well. Whoopity-do.
So, when I received information that Brody had called into the Green and Gold postgame show, I'm thinking, great, he's going to call in. He's going to get really cocky about how you doubted the Vikings. We're Scolgers. We're NFC North champions for the second time in 3 years. I was expecting cocky Brody. What the heck was that? What was that?
I don't know. I don't know how to explain that.
Either
Rodgers was sad?
Either two things going on here. Yeah, he's a Pack. Brody's either a Packers fan.
Yeah, deep down he might be.
Because, he said we.
Yeah.
He said, yeah. Talking about Aaron Rodgers being sad.
Brody sounded sad.
Or the second part, he was planning on flipping the second part of the conversation and then starting to troll. And I think the hosts were smart enough to recognize this isn't a very good call, so let's just get rid of this one while we can.
Yeah.
Because those hosts, believe me, the sound bites I play for you on calls, I have to cut into a little something. They let callers go on and on and on. Like, they'll make their points and then go back to callers. That's not how we really do it here at The Fan. So it's not often they just completely cut off someone in the middle of a segment, and well, and apparently he's called in. If this is him, Brody. Brody,
hello?
Are you there?
Yeah. No.
Why did you call the Green and Gold post game show yesterday? And what the heck were you trying to do?
Who says that was me?
It was Brody from La Crosse.
You've got to be kidding me!
And he goes,
"I don't live in La Crosse."
Well, people can lie about it, you know, Brody. You could make something up to get in on the Green and Gold post game show. It happens all the time.
I want to set this straight. Now, if that was me, and I'm not saying it was, but if that was me, you know, when you prank somebody, you kind of got to set it up a little bit. Have you ever done a prank call before?
No. Can you give me an example of how I could prank somebody?
Well, let me just tell you this.
Hey, Brody, is your refrigerator running right now?
Oh, hilarious. What you need to do is you gotta bring them along a little bit and make you think that you're a real Packer fan. Now, then they just decided to cut me off before I could tell them that
if it was you,
division champions, Skol Vikings, Minneapolis Super Bowl.
Yeah, I think they caught on that it wasn't a very bright call.
Well,
you should have just come out firing guns ablaze and right away, bro.
Acting. Have you ever heard of a thing called acting?
I've heard of it, but I'm not very good at it.
Okay. Now, I don't think... You heard the rest of those other calls. They sounded more pitiful than I did. I mean, than I would have. Right?
Yeah. All right, well, it was an attempt at a prank call, but I don't think it turned out too well for you. You still there?
Wow, we lost him.
Apparently dropped. Like. You couldn't take it anymore.
So he admits it was him.
Well, yeah, he did at the end there. If it was him.
Yeah, if it was him.
One thing on the Aaron Rodgers conversation, because this is going to be something that I'm sure will be ongoing all week. I hear a lot of people doing the old, you got to sit Aaron out. Why risk his long-term future for the slim chance to get to the playoffs? And frankly, we'll know more tonight whether they still have a chance at the playoffs, and that might have an impact on the decision. To me, if I'm Green Bay, I play him. He played last week. He didn't get hurt. And the whole mortgaging your future, what's the worst that's going to happen? He probably re-breaks the collarbone?
Yeah, that's the worst.
That's the worst that's going to happen,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So your season's done, and you sit out for 2 months anyway. And you're going to be 100% from next year. It's not one of those injuries that's, you know, it's not like your ACL that you're coming back when it's still partially torn and you have a chance to shred your knee, which is going to be a career, you know, potential career-ending implications. Breaks his collarbone, he can get healthy during the offseason. That's what the offseason's for. He'll be 100% by next year. And it's not like him being out there with his collarbone is going to have some sort of impact on the rest of his body, right? It's not like Sam Bradford when he was out against Chicago where he could barely move, and now you're putting yourself where you're much more vulnerable to a chance to get hit all the time, and you could injure something else, even though it might not even just correlate to that injury. He can run, he can move, he's mobile. Apparently he didn't throw the ball well yesterday, but apparently he could throw. For sure, if they still have a chance for playoffs, I'm putting him in there. If you're mathematically still available 2 weeks to go, I'm playing. And you're telling me he doesn't want to get back at the Vikings?
Oh, he does.
And if you're a Packers fan, do you want to watch Brett Hundley or do you want to watch Aaron Rodgers? You're getting paid millions of dollars. They're paying lots of money for you to play. And I'm sure he wants to play. I'm sure he wants to go back. I'm sure he wants to do the belt thing to Anthony Barr after he runs one in for a touchdown. Let him play. I haven't heard that he got hurt anymore in last game.
No, he came out okay.
Even if they're out of the playoffs, I'd still play him.
Now, I do have a little bit on this because, well, yesterday, Dave Sinekin, he was obviously hosting Packer Preview, and he talked about, you know, if the way that cookie crumbles, if the Vikings have the playoff seeds wrapped up and the the green and gold are eliminated. He still thinks that Rodgers should play and will play and play the role of spoiler. So he thinks that Rodgers will want to play.
It's your division rival. It won't matter.
Right, exactly. So I thought, you know, we're going to be facing Rodgers regardless of what happens in tonight's Monday Night Football game.
He should play.
However, according to NFL.com, let me read you this quote. It should come as little surprise considering NFL Network's insider Ian Rappaport's pregame report that the collarbone is, quote, not 100% healed. If the Falcons beat the Buccaneers on Monday Night Football, the Packers face postseason elimination and the likelihood that Rodgers will pack it in to avoid re-injury. So according to NFL.com, if the Falcons win tonight and the Packers are eliminated... They're going to pack it up.
And that does change things a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? To me, if they're mathematically still available, it's a no-brainer to play him. If they're out of the playoffs, then I think we can have the debate. If he wants to play, I'd still play him. That's me. It's not going to be something that's going to affect next year, and it's not going to affect his career. Five questions is next.
Will Tennessee call for the abolishment of the current rules surrounding what is and what is not a catch in the NFL?
Coming out, Tana B in. You're listening to Brandon Molesky on The Fan.
Michael Russo, about a half hour from now. Mike Zimmer, press conference, about an hour from now. But now...
Time now for... Five questions. Well, actually three, but five sounds like more than four. Question number one.
Tennessee, Jesse James, tight end for the Steelers, had a catch to look like it was going to win the game for the Steelers, but it was overturned after being ruled a touchdown on the field. It was the old Dez Bryant rule. He caught it, extended the ball over the goal line, but the ball wiggled in his hands as it went to the ground. They called it incomplete. So, Tenno, we seem to have one of these almost every week with the old mantra, well, we all know it was a catch, but yes, according to the way the rule is written, it was not a catch. Similar to the non-Thielen touchdown catch in Carolina last week. So, Tenno, I ask you, is it time to change the rule that everyone seems to universally hate?
Well, I wouldn't even compare this one to Thielen. The Dez Bryant comparison was exactly right. And you know, I don't even know who's in charge now in the NFL of determining the reviews, because they got the referee with the little iPad. Is he still making the decision now, or is it like the NHL where they go to New York? I don't even know what they do now, because I thought they'd switched it to the referee who gets like a tablet to make it a little quicker. You know they were watching that replay just dreading the decision they had to make. Because if you're going to come out and say Dez Bryant, and that was at Lambeau, right? That was against the Green Bay Packers in the playoffs?
Yes.
Clearly a catch. Clearly a catch. But if you're going to say that Dez Bryant one was not a catch, then you have to rule the Jesse James one to not be a catch. And by the letter of the law and by the rule, they got it right yesterday. That rule is idiotic. It is so dumb. And I wouldn't even compare it to the Thielen thing. Because both the Dez Bryant one and the Jesse James one, the player catches the ball, is trying to score a touchdown. So they reach the ball over the goal line. Should be a touchdown. But then as they fall down, the ball hits the, you know. And it wasn't like the David Carr one yesterday, or Derek Carr. The David or Derek, I'm getting confused. Derek Carr.
Derek Carr.
It's not like one where he fumbled it before the goal line, right? This is different. The ball was in the end zone. The ball moved because of making contact with the ground. I don't know as a receiver how you can hold on to the thing while you're falling down, reaching over the end zone, and then have it hit the ground and be able to hold on. That'd be tough to not have it shift or move in your hands. It's such a dumb rule. If you want to keep the feeling one in there, which even that one I find to be a little ridiculous, but... You know, if a guy is catching the ball in the end zone and doesn't fully come down with it, or it shifts a little bit in your hands as you hit the ground, that's one thing. If a guy is taking the ball and putting it over the goal line because he wants to score a touchdown, he's showing that he has possession because he's moving the ball with his hands. That's what both Dez Bryant and Jesse James did. I caught the ball, I'm on my way down, but I need to get the ball in the end zone. So that ball doesn't move past the goal line unless they have possession of the ball. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's a terrible way to lose. It's a really bad way to determine who's going to end up being the number one seed in the AFC, right? It changes your opponent. So now Pittsburgh's likely to have Jacksonville as opposed to one of those other 8-6 teams that are just awful right now in the AFC, the Tennessees and the Buffaloes of the world, and who maybe Kansas City. So you're going to have a more difficult opponent to get to the AFC championship, and then once you get there, you got to go to New England, which, good luck to you. And, you know, Pittsburgh played that game about as well as they could yesterday. I mean, they limited, other than that last drive, which was absolutely surgical by Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski, until then, Tom Brady didn't look like any different of a quarterback. Threw an interception, didn't have the same completion rate. Pittsburgh played a lot of that game without Antonio Brown and still was able to move offensively pretty much at will. Disappointing way to lose the game. And then on top of that, Big Ben throws the interception, which if you just throw an incomplete pass, you got a gimme field goal to force the thing to overtime. Right. So it was just double whammy of awful rule goes against you, and then not the best decision to throw that ball probably by Big Ben.
And before that surgical drive where Brady was just connecting with Gronk down the field to take the lead, 28 for the Steelers, Mike Davis. I can't remember. Maybe it's Mike Davis. Anyways, dropped the most perfectly placed interception just in his hands. I couldn't believe my eyes.
A little tougher than you're giving it credit for, but you know,
maybe a little.
You know, the ball was kind of behind him a little bit. It wasn't a gimme, but yeah, you're right. He should have had.
You got to catch that. And he was the one who was covering Gronk the entire drive. Every single completion was on 28.
Well, just imagine if yesterday's game was the AFC Championship. I mean, the drama that played out, and to have that controversial of a play end somebody's season and bring someone to the Super Bowl. You'd be talking about that all offseason. And frankly, I do think the catch rule is going to be brought up again this offseason. And like I said, if you want to leave the Thielen type play where you're catching it in the end zone, 2 feet land, and then you kind of lose the ball as you hit the ground, that's fine. And the reason they do that is because they don't want any gray area. They don't want to have referees make any subjective decisions, which is actually kind of their role in the sport. But to me, you need to eliminate the "I've caught the ball and I'm reaching for the goal line." At that point, it should be a touchdown even before the thing hits the ground. To me, that's the one part I think you can shave off that rule.
Question number two. The state of the state of hockey.
Well, I wish we had more positive Wild news to share here on this question, but the Wild dropped a pair of games over the weekend, and last night it was in convincing fashion against the Speedy Blackhawks. 4-0 was the final. And tonight I ask you, because the Wild seem to be streaky. They've won 4 straight before dropping the last 2. The season kind of seems to be going on this roller coaster ride. I want your thoughts on the loss, and do you expect the roller coaster of ups and downs to continue all year, or once the Wild get fully healthy with Dubnyk and Parisi on the mend, will they play more consistent eventually?
Well, average mediocre teams are going to have winning stretches, and they're going to have losing stretches, and that's what they are. They're just kind of a middle-of-the-road team, hopefully enough to get in the playoffs, which I think is going to be a little dicey. I think we're going to be kind of in this spot all season long. The A topic you're missing out here is Matt Dumba is halfway to Jason Zucker's Wild record of most consecutive goals by your team. He scored all 3 goals this weekend.
Oh, yeah, good point.
He scored the 2 against Edmonton. He scored the only goal last night. He's got 3 in a row. So who do they got, Ottawa tomorrow night?
Yeah.
Add 1 or 2, you might be knocking on the door of that Jason Zucker record.
Why not a hat trick tomorrow night? Let's just go. Let's just get it done.
Yeah.
I like that. We needed some offense from Dumba, so that's good.
This team is much different than they were last year. And the stat that, other than the penalty stat, the stat that might be the scariest is last year, the Wild gave up 40 or more shots on goal in a game 6 times all season. They did that in 82 games. Last night, they did it for the 6th time this season. That's through 33 games.
Wow.
That shows you how much more lopsided the zone possession is for the opposite team this year compared to last year. and the amount of chances and shots that our goalies are facing on a game-in, game-out basis. The squad, I thought, over that winning stretch had gotten a little bit better defensively. I thought the goaltending was pretty solid. Stalock's been pretty good since taking over for Dubnyk. But you can't play defense. It's difficult to win, and they're not a good enough offensive team to overcome not being good enough defensively, if that makes any sense at all. They don't have a lot of scoring depth. Unless Granlund and Nino are going, and Stahl's going, they can't really find offense from other spots. We saw it again last night. And Chicago, by the way, looked really good last night. That's a team that's flying. All three of their goals, the fourth one is an empty netter. The three goals prior to that were just highlight reel, elite goals, on the rush, snipes. The third goal was unbelievable shot. They look good, and right now that's kind of a team that you have to catch or leapfrog to get into that top eight, and that's not a team I want to have to do that against. So I do think it's going to be win some, lose some, because that's what average teams do.
Question number three.
Case Keenum went 20 of 23 yesterday, had two touchdown passes, no turnovers, and the Vikings' big win over Cincy. Tenna, why is Case not getting more MVP consideration, and what is it going to take for him to do so?
Because his name's Case Keenum, and he's always been bad in the past, and he played for the Texans and the Rams, and has never been thought of as a starting quarterback. Even now, I don't know if a lot of the National Football League people respect him a whole lot, because, right, it's one of those things that if they're not on national television a lot, and you're not watching them or watching them play, like, I look at Jacksonville's record and I go, wow, they're really, really good. I haven't seen them play once this year. Even when they played in London, I wasn't watching that morning. So is Blake Bortles having a good season, or is he just have such a good defense that it's kind of overshadowing that he's been kind of mediocre, right? That Jacksonville defense might be the 85 Bears defense for all I know. I haven't seen them play. But if I watched them, I might go, wow. And I think the same thing applies to Case Keenum. If you haven't been watching Case Keenum play, other than the few nationally televised games they've had, you probably just go, oh, he's Case Keenum. He's just, he's not a pretty good backup quarterback, maybe a low-end starting quarterback. That's kind of always what he's been in his career. He's not the biggest guy, wasn't a first-round draft pick. They're clearly winning because their defense is great. And really, if you look at it, I'm curious to see how this is going to play out in terms of MVP, and I know we still have two more weeks left, because some of your MVP candidates probably have dropped off just based on injury, right? Carson Wentz, is he still considered an MVP?
No.
Now that he's not going to play, like, does the injury eliminate him?
Yes, I think it does.
What if Antonio Brown misses the last two games?
He's officially out to the playoffs.
Is he officially out?
They just said that on NFL Network.
Okay. So does that affect his status, right? Tom Brady is really good. I don't think Tom Brady is having Tom Brady-type years that he's had in the past in terms of numbers. Actually, I think Keenum's numbers are pretty comparable to
Tom
Brady's.
Very comparable, yeah.
Right? So it's always teams, it's always the top teams that are going to have guys eligible. The Steelers, now that Brown's out there, I don't look at Big Ben as an MVP candidate, though he's been much better second half of the season than he was earlier. I'm not sure if you put Le'Veon Bell there. So you've got Brady with the Patriots, right? In the NFC, your top team is the Eagles. If you're now going to eliminate Carson Wentz because of that, then he's eliminated. Second team is Minnesota, and if you're going to pick anyone, you'd pick Case Keenum. I do think Todd Gurley might get some late run here, especially after his performance yesterday with the four touchdowns. He might become a candidate with a Rams team that kind of came out of nowhere. I think Russell Wilson's kind of off the bandwagon for MVP. He was getting some love before.
Especially after last night. He's out.
Right? You look at the Saints, people have thrown Drew Brees' name out there. Drew Brees, compared to past passing seasons, maybe there's just the fantasy guy in me coming out, has not put up the numbers. He just has a great running game now. A two-headed monster there with Ingram and Kamara, and the defense is much better there. I don't look at the season Brees has had and go, that's an MVP-type season, right? So Jacksonville's record's good. Who are you going to put there? Leonard Fournette's been out for X amount of games now. He might have been that candidate, but now he's not. I mean, Case Keenum's going to be top five, if not top three. I think he will be.
Absolutely.
And we still have two games to go, and that can change things. I'm trying to think, who else? Right? It's not going to be Cam Newton. It's not going to be Matt Ryan or
I don't
Julio.
Think there's any defensive player that's kind of stood out to be able to be considered an MVP. So, yeah, I mean,
It'll probably end up being Brady just by default, because they'll end up with the best record in the AFC. They'll be the number one seed. He's the best player, and he's got the track record. But there's not a lot of other options. To me, Case Keenum's going to be top three. I think he will be. Well, that was too long-winded for you.
That's okay.
And that's it for today's edition of Five Questions. Well, actually, three questions, but five sounds like more than four.
I want to talk about the return of Teddy and a team in the NFC that is no one is talking about, but they might want to. We'll do that next.
It's the Green Giants, Brandon Molesky, filling in for Common on The Fan.
Emails at the Bradshaw and Bryant inbox. That's booth@kfan.com. Brandon Molesky here, broadcasting from the Bryant Heating and Cooling Studios, in for the Common Man Dan Cole today. South Dakota listener guy says, good afternoon. I don't see why the rule for making a falling catch is different than a normal catch. How many times do we see a receiver make an easy catch in the end zone and almost immediately drops the ball to the ground to celebrate? Some of these falling catches have more and longer times of control than some of the easy touchdown grabs. Call them touchdowns, call them catches. Why not look to what the NCAA does? I do not recall college football having a problem with this. What does the NCAA do? Do you know what their catch rules are?
You know,
well, I mean, I know they only need 1 foot in.
They review
two.
Everything in the NCAA. I mean, when I run Gopher
games,
that's
when their games are 4.5 hours long.
Correct. I mean, yeah. It's literally. I mean, I don't think they have any limits on it. I think it always comes from the referee. There's no coaches' challenges or anything like that. So anytime there's kind of a question, they just go to the replay. And it takes too long, in my opinion. But it is what it is.
Well, it does, and you want it to be. Yeah, there's always a fine line between getting the call right and not dragging on the pace of the game. I would just say, let's go back to just the common sense rule. Let's stop with the completing the process of the catch and having all these exact rules so we have no gray area and everything's black and white. Why can't we just have the referees just look at it and go, I think that was a catch. Let's just do common sense. Because common sense tells me the Jesse James one was a catch. Common sense tells me Adam Thielen's was a catch. Common sense tells me Megatron against the Bears years ago was a catch. That one was brutal. And the Dez Bryant one. It's just, you look at it, he caught it, and he reached over the end zone because he had possession of it. And it is funny how, yeah, how many times did they catch a ball in the end zone and immediately drop the ball to celebrate?
Oh, that, all
that's
the time.
A catch, yet Jesse James catches it, gets one knee down, is falling down, reaches over, doesn't fumble as he's reaching over. He fumbles because the ground causes contact or loses the ball. I shouldn't say fumble.
They called it, he did not survive the ground, is the way the referee put it.
Yet if you're a running back and you lose the ball, could hit the ground, that's not a fumble.
Ground can't cause a fumble.
We don't call that a fumble.
Funny.
But we will call it an incomplete pass if the ground causes it when you clearly had possession or reaching over.
Well, the problem with, like, going with the common sense route is, well, deep down, I agree with you. Like, I wish that you could just do that. But then you're going to set yourself up for even more gray area and controversy. You have to have some defined rule, which is unfortunate because we both agree that the rule is terrible. But you have to have it. I think it's the necessary evil.
Regarding my, I would play Aaron Rodgers comment if I'm the Green Bay Packers, regardless of whether they are in playoff contention or not. Al writes, dumb. Anytime you play, you could blow out a knee. If that happens, he will miss part of next year. Sure, there's always an inherent risk anytime you're out on the field. But then what you're saying to me, and maybe you would continue this, if Aaron Rodgers was 100% healthy, he's 100% healthy, and the Packers were out of playoff contention, would you then sit Aaron Rodgers then too? Because you have to follow it up with that. Because his collarbone has zero impact on whether he gets injured anywhere else. And let's face it, he's been pretty healthy over his career. He's a smart player for the most part. Other than the Anthony Barr play, he knows how to avoid the big hit. He knows how to avoid contact. But his collarbone has no impact on any other body part that could get hurt. Could he re-hurt his collarbone? Yes. He'll be back 100% healthy with that. That's not a career-ending injury or something that's going to have an impact on him the rest of his career and bring him back down to earth. So, yeah, he could blow out of the year. Well, then all of your star players, every star player around the league on a team that's not going to be in the playoffs should be sitting this week if that's your opinion on it. Correct?
You can't argue that.
San Francisco better sit Jimmy Garoppolo.
Yeah.
They're 4-10.
You can't risk losing him for next year.
They can't.
They're out of the playoffs.
They can't go to the playoffs, so they better take him out. Right?
Right.
Chicago Bears better sit Jordan Howard and Mitchell Trubisky against the Vikings in Week 17. And while you're at it, you might as well sit Jordy Nelson and Devontae Adams. I would say a defensive star, but I don't know if they have any.
Devontae Adams probably isn't going to play in all seriousness because he had a concussion.
He had a concussion. That's a whole nother
cheap shot by
that's a whole nother
Thomas
thing.
Davis.
And while we're on injuries, Teddy Bridgewater, I don't know if you heard, came back from an injury.
I did hear that, yes.
I'm not one of those guys that gets too emotional over sporting events. A lot of times, a lot of the moments that are meant to be emotional, I feel like are kind of manufactured sometimes, right? It's the old, how many times a year is a local sporting team going to bring back some guy that used to play for your team? And he was a good player, but wasn't even a star player, but we got to give him a standing ovation because he hit 275 one year. You're right? I mean, it happens all. Sometimes we overdo it. I wasn't at U.S. Bank Stadium yesterday. I could hear clearly through our ISDN line switching back through the control board here, mm-hmm. which we then put out on the radio, how cool of a moment that was. You could tell. A lot of times with crowd noise, you can't tell. Is that really loud? Is it really quiet? Are they piping up the noise? You could tell that those fans meant everything they did with cheering him on. And to me, I don't care what you say. I know he went out and he threw an interception and he was 0-for-2 and didn't really do anything from a game standpoint. He almost was never going to play again.
Right.
And imagine having something that you love, and he clearly loves football, right? He's not one of those guys that's just out there playing for the paycheck. He loves the game. He has a passion for it. He has a passion for his teammates. He has a passion for his coaches. And you can tell, looking at his face, how much it means to him to be back out there. Heck, he was crying just his first game back in uniform, and he didn't even play.
Yeah, during the Star Spangled Banner.
Was that at Washington?
Yeah.
Right? He was tearing up over that
because
it meant so much to him to be back wearing that uniform again. So not only to see how much it meant to him, but to see Case Keenum applauding and Kyle Rudolph and Stephon Diggs waving the towels, getting the crowd going, which is usually what you don't want to do when you're out on offense. That was a really cool moment yesterday. And I got this email from Bobby that says, everyone is happy for Teddy, and rightfully so. The amount of work and the medical miracle to have a chance to play again is a testament to his will. But is it slightly, embracing, I don't know if he means embarrassing, for Keenum that he brings us a playoff game and the NFC Championship, but they chant Teddy at the game? I don't think, none of the Teddy chants had to do with, we want Teddy Bridgewater to be our starting quarterback. It was, we are going to show a lot of love to a guy who has given everything he can to put on a Minnesota Vikings jersey and has done it with class the entire time.
Oh, and Case was there waving the towel.
Yeah.
He was chanting too. I mean, I bet you Case was chanting Teddy along. I mean, he was pumping up the crowd. And I was at the game. That was one of the best moments I think I've ever been a part of at a football game. And it had nothing to do with the game itself. It was the whole stadium chanting Teddy, 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 and everyone cheering. And it really didn't even do it justice on the radio or on TV. Because I listened back to it this morning when I was putting together the montage. And it sounded unbelievable on the radio.
Yeah.
But it still didn't do it justice how loud and emotional everyone was at that point. And then you see Teddy coming onto the field, and it doesn't matter what he actually did, and who cares that he threw the interception? It's not about that.
See, and that's the thing is on Twitter, because I know you shouldn't judge things being written on Twitter, especially during a Vikings game, because that's when the crazies come out. But as he's going on the field, all I tweeted was, I love Teddy, right? Then he throws the interception, and now I have people on my timeline. That's why Case should have been the guy all along. Teddy's not a very good quarterback. 2 years ago, he was never a good quarterback. The interception, was it a perfect pass? No. Was it a little high? It should have been caught by Jerick McKinnon. The next drive, the pass to Floyd, should have been caught. So he was 0-for-2 with an interception with two balls that weren't perfectly placed, but went through the hands of his receivers on both times, and then he handed the ball. He didn't play bad. He wasn't even bad. I'm not saying pull Case Keenum and put in Teddy Bridgewater, but It's just amazing the amount of people that just jump on his back because they threw an interception. That wasn't his.
It really wasn't his fault.
It was more on the running back than him.
And it was completely meaningless. It was at a meaningless point in the game. The game was out of hand.
And he could have thrown four interceptions, and it was just cool to have him back. And
exactly.
He's seeing game speed for the first time. And even more so than just the moment, I thought it was important, and we might end up seeing this in the Chicago game in Week 17, depending on where we are on the standings and seeding-wise at that point. I'd like to see Teddy get an opportunity in Chicago, maybe second half or so, or a quarter. Get him a couple more drives, because if something does happen to Case Keenum come playoff time, it would be nice to have a guy who's been out for 2 years have more than just really two very short drives, because they were both, one was an interception and one was three and out. And really, he got a little taste of what it's like to have game speed again thrown back at him, but really didn't get a taste. Hopefully the Vikings put themselves in a situation where they have a first round bye and have a comfortable lead against Chicago where second half and go, Teddy, go to work, let's get you some look, because if for some reason you have to depend on Teddy in the middle of a game, I would feel more comfortable with him getting a little bit more action than he has. Michael Russo from The Athletic, he is next to talk about the Wild's bad weekend.
You're listening to Brandon Molesky on The Fan.
Schmalt skates right along the blue line, drops for Kane in the slot, does his spin, doesn't shoot. Now he does. It's blocked by Ennis. Puck winds up in the right corner. Time is going to run out on Patrick Kane's hat trick, but not on the Chicago win, as the Blackhawks beat the Wild tonight by a score of 4-1.
After four straight wins, the Minnesota Wild have two straight losses. They lose Saturday 3-2 to Edmonton. And then in Chicago last night, they lose by a score of 4-1. Brandon Molesky and Ryan Donaldson now being joined by Michael Russo, beat writer for the Minnesota Wild from The Athletic. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Very good. How are you?
Good. That looked like a Wild Blackhawks game we've seen before. Patrick Kane scoring and Corey Crawford shutting down the team again.
Yeah, you know, it's actually funny. I mean, the regular season, the Wild actually been quite victorious for, you know, last several years in Chicago. And just last night, you know, playing the second of a back-to-back game, it was just the absolute, you know, worst thing that you could possibly do. And that's kind of begin the parade to the penalty box. Took a penalty in the first period, took three in the second, and then two more in the third. And you know, after a quality start where they just weren't able to score a goal, you just knew that eventually the legs would get under them. It doesn't help them when all of a sudden you're in the box all night and you're killing penalty after penalty. And the Wild, they've got to figure out a way to get more discipline. I think that a lot of this is because they're not nearly the fast team that they used to be. Their possession numbers have been terrible. And when you're chasing the puck all night, you're going to take lazy, bad penalties. And that's clearly what the Wild are doing right now.
Yeah, I was just going to have you explain, you know, because you probably have the stat with you of how lopsided the the power plays compared to the penalty kills have been over the last, you know, 10, 12 games or whatever. I mean, they're pretty much getting doubled up, and this has always been a disciplined team.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they were even in power play differential up until 12 games ago, and now it is 56-26 in favor of
crazy.
The opponent being on a power play. I mean, that's nuts. So the 56 power plays against is by far the most in the league, and the minus 30 differential is a ton. And this, as all Wild fans know, this is not a big aggressive team. You know, I remember when Anaheim was, you know, always in a position where they were just taking penalty after penalty, you could blame it on ruggedness and not being disciplined. Well, the Wild's discipline is just, you know, sticking fractions and hooking and holes.
Yes.
Look, I know the Wild, you know, especially if you ask management, they think they've been getting the short end of the shrift for a while here in terms of soft calls or especially, you know, non-calls. But last night was an example where they just need to be better. They were chasing the puck the entire second, third period. They're taking offensive zone penalties. They're taking undisciplined too many men penalties. Bad line change leads to the second goal. They're not playing, you know, the way that we were accustomed to see them last year, and there just comes a point where you just have to wonder if this is who they are.
Well, and thankfully their penalty kill has been pretty darn good. Now, last night they were, you know, 0 for 6. Chicago was on the power play, yet I felt like their power play was better than those numbers indicate, you know, in terms of the chances they had. But other than last night, the Wild penalty kill has been phenomenal, which has really allowed them to even be, you know, have a chance in a lot of these games.
especially at home. At home, they have the fourth best penalty kill in the NHL, and you're right. I mean, they've been shorthanded a gazillion times and have killed them. And so, you know, they're just and you've seen. I mean, the penalty kill personnel has changed a lot this year because Boudreau is trying to use. You know, the Wild are a weird team. A lot of teams would like to use the third and fourth liners on the penalty kill to save their big guys. But the Wild have guys like Chris Stewart on their third and fourth line, Tyler Ennis, guys that he would never want to, that Bruce would never want to put on the penalty kill. So he uses guys, you know, like Stahl and people like that a lot. So he's tried to use more and more third and fourth liners when they come up, the Erickson X, using more of Cullen lately. There's one other third, you know, when Winnick's in the lineup, obviously Winnick, and suddenly guys like Nino and Granlund are doing almost no penalty killing this year to try to keep them fresh for even strength and power play. And obviously, you know, last night's a game where all of a sudden you're not using Granlund and Nino in the second period. So not only, you know, so you're tiring out guys, and then you have guys like Nino and Granlund who are just getting out of a rhythm because they're never getting off the bench, and clearly. Last night was an example where Nino and Granlund were not very good.
A guy who hasn't been very good for quite some time would be Mikko Koivu. And Michael, you've been here for a long time, so you know over the last 5 years, it seems like every year there's a stretch in which Mikko struggles, and then you know, and people do the old, he's done, he's too old, he's too slow, his career's over. So we've been here before. That being said, at one of these years, that's just going to be the way he is moving forward. But any explanation for the play of Mikko Koivu in recent games?
No, because, you know, I mean, and the thing is that I don't even think, and frankly, we haven't heard management and coaches use the old excuse, well, he does so many things in different areas, because he's even struggling in those areas right now. I mean, that's the thing that's scary, is that at least in the past, when, you know, he wasn't scoring, he added in so many different ways, whether it's face-offs or shutting down other or creating possession, or at least, you know, playing a lot in the offensive zone that created creative possession. And now the Wild are in a situation where he just has, you know, he's not winning draws. On the penalty kill 2 games ago, you know, 2 bad clears, you know, tired-looking clears that put them in a position where they were stuck in their own end another 30, 40 seconds. And, you know, watching and playing this game, Brandon, you know, the second you start getting into 40, 50 second shifts where you're in your own end, it's hard to get out of that that type of habit, because next thing you know, you're finally getting off for a change and the other team's coming on the line change and the next group is out in 30, 40. So he just hasn't been very good. And you know, you mentioned the long stretches. Last year he had a really quality first 3 quarters of the season, and then he seemed to really die. And now it's filtered into this year where there has not been a lot of great play by Mikko. I thought he got off to a relatively fast start, but right now it is clearly weighing on him that he's not scoring. It's been 24 games, hasn't scored a goal since October 28th, and even more concerning, he's not yet even getting close to getting points right now. He has no points in 11 games. That's the worst stretch in his career, and it seems like everybody that goes on his line is kind of fallen by that, you know, is kind of dying as well. So I like that Bruce yesterday got Granlund away from him, put him back with Stahl, where those two were successful in Anaheim and San Jose. But it's becoming a huge issue here. You know, last night I liked the makeup of that Ennis, Coyle, and Niederreiter line. But man, Zucker, Koivu, and Stewart did nothing. And it just seems like whatever, it's not good when you got to hide your 20 minute a night captain.
I was just going to ask you about Zucker, because last night he looked like he was laboring. And I know I know he took the slap shot to the knee and left part of the game against Edmonton, the Ryan Suter slap shot. Who would have thought a Ryan Suter slap shot would hurt somebody? But, you know, I know he left for a little bit, came back in that game. I thought last night he looked like a guy that was just absolutely hobbling and laboring.
Yeah.
And is that strictly due to the Suter shot? Did he have another injury that we didn't know of? And if it is just the Suter thing, how severe is it that he's playing through here?
Yeah, you know, I mean, he says that he's fine, that it was just kind of a stinger or whatever. Last night, I just think, you know, there's been a kind of a stretch of games lately where he's, you know, hasn't passed particularly well and hasn't created a ton. And obviously, I think he only has 1 goal in his last 9 games. Nino's got 1 goal in his last 11. There are a lot of guys on the team that I just don't think are skating well. I don't think Nino has been skating well for, honestly, 2 months. I think that high ankle sprain is just tough to come back from. You saw it last night where he had a chance to wheel by a guy and he just couldn't get any pick-me-up, and that was very early in his shift. And you're talking about a guy that's in terrific shape. And then, you know, obviously Granlin came into camp, hurt, and then, wound up hurting his groin the day before camp. I just think that there, you have, and then you got Coyle coming back from the broken leg. I just think that you got three or four guys that, you know, have been these things, even when you come back in the lineup, it's not like you're magically 100%. I just think that they, and this isn't to, you know, excuse any of their play this year, but I just think that they, you have four or five guys that aren't skating up to probably the way that we're normally accustomed to seeing them skate.
Talking with Michael Russo of The Athletic, Brandon Molesky in for the Common Man. The Wild lose last night in Chicago by a score of 4-1. They get Ottawa tomorrow night, 6 o'clock game. And that must mean, Michael, that the Ottawa Fire story, the annual Ottawa Fire story, is coming to The Athletic soon, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't write it because I don't want to give, Tony DaCosta, their equipment manager, has gone through years of therapy. I don't want to just bring up all the bad memories. But the fact that today was the exact 8-year anniversary of the Ottawa Fire.
Oh, was it?
In Ottawa. Yeah.
And wow.
The fact that they're in Ottawa, that's why I kind of went on the little history lesson. But if you don't remember, back in 2009, Chuck Fletcher's first year as GM, the Wild were going through the swine flu, actually. They were in Montreal, and they go to Ottawa after the game, and a bunch of guys were sick. And all of a sudden, they go and practice at a practice rink in Kanata, and they're on the way back, and the equipment truck gets to the arena. And thank God that they got to the arena as quick. If they were going to the airport, that would have been an absolute disaster. But it was a short drive. The equipment guys get out of the front part of the bed, and they go and they look in the rear, and the entire back part of the truck is on fire. And they lost about 12 guys, lost all their equipment. Most guys lost a lot of their equipment. It turned out to be a blowtorch that started it. But if you remember, what happened was Matt Benz, who's now their assistant equipment manager, he was back here. He had to go to their practice rink at Parade and get a bunch of practice gear. Guys like Nick Schultz went to Play It Again Sports, a local sports shop in Ottawa, to buy shoulder pads and things like that. And the next night they played in all kind of hand-me-down gear. They also played shorthanded. Two guys missed the game because of the swine flu, and it was one of the flattest performances. I know Wild fans are accustomed to flat performances, but this was a really flat performance.
Between that and then the story of the fire at Craig Leopold's cottage, they've had too many fire stories for this franchise.
No, well, how about the other one? I'm writing a cool story about their team services, their team operations manager, and just all the stuff that he does behind the scenes for this team. But his third day on the job, or a week on the job, they're in Calgary. They fly in from Edmonton. He texts the hotel rep. And they're like, hey, we're 20 minutes from there. If you can have the rooms ready, it's like a 1 a.m. And they get to the hotel, and the entire hotel's on fire. And this guy, a week on the job, he had to sprint all around in the middle of the heart of January in the wintertime around downtown Calgary trying to find hotels for 40 people.
I'm pretty sure I had four questions regarding the Blue Line. So let's just get to this one first. The decision to send down Murphy and keep Riley, I know they were both, a game away from, having to clear waivers to ever get sent down again. Is the plan to trade Riley here? Do they want to keep him long-term? And why did Murphy get sent down instead of Riley?
Well, I mean, it's a total coincidence that they both needed waivers after one game. Basically, the deal with Murphy is that, he has needed waivers for the last several years, but when you pass through waivers during training camp, you're allowed to be called up for nothing, and then you could be on the team for 10 games or 30 days before you have to go on waivers again. Well, yesterday would have been his 10th game, so they sent him down. In terms of Riley, this is now for the rest of his career. He played his 70th game last night. He's going to need waivers to get down to Iowa. So they decided to stick with him. The reason why is that, there's several reasons why, but Bruce wanted to keep Prosser in the lineup. He obviously has Dumba and Spurgeon coming back and Dumba, so those are three right shot guys. To him, it made no sense to put Murphy on the third pair, especially if he wasn't going to be on the power play, and put Prosser on the left side, so they kept Riley here. But now, I think at some point something probably has to give. Bruce made it very clear that he wants to get Murphy eventually back up here, so I do think a trade is coming. I will say, I've heard chattering out there that Riley is on the trading block, or even that Riley wouldn't mind getting traded. But when I brought that to Chuck Fletcher's attention the other day to ask him what I was hearing, he completely denied that he's shopping Mikey Riley. But, who knows? Like I said, I've been hearing from a lot of people, and if you just, can I connect the dots here, you got to think at some point they'd be willing to trade Riley or Olofsson.
All right, well, let's stick with the Blue Line. Jared Spurgeon comes back last night. They put him with Jonas Brodin. And they keep Matt Dumba with Ryan Suter. Apparently in training camp or preseason, that's what Bruce Boudreau wanted. Something must have happened that they did not go that route. And now, at least for a couple games here, we'll see if it continues. Suter playing with Dumba. Is Suter okay playing with Dumba? And the, you know, is Suter kind of calling his own shots on who he gets to play with? And if so, that can't imagine that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that Suter would love to play with Spurgeon, and I think that, you know, Dumba's been better, but I think Dumba is also kind of, and Bruce admitted it yesterday, has really, hung Suter out to dry several times, where all of a sudden, I mean, when have we ever seen Suter have to defend as many two-on-ones as he had to, the last 2 weeks? But they've been victorious. Dumba is playing 26, 27 minutes a night, and he's scoring goals suddenly, and it clearly having the safety net of Suter is helping his game offensively, but he's still making the kind of questionable decisions defensively that we've grown accustomed to seeing from him. For now, they're going to keep Spurgeon with Brodin, which is the way that Boudreau did want to start the season. It's the way they were all throughout the training camp, to have kind of a defensive pair. But I do think at the first sign of adversity, like if this trip goes haywire, I can guarantee we're going to see, especially when Spurgeon gets his legs back to under him, we'll probably see Spurgeon back with Suter at some point. Spurgeon, I thought, you know, was pretty good yesterday. Definitely a little rusty. There was one play in the second period I thought that he really, in the first period, I think he tried to force a play to his buddy when he probably should have just unleashed the puck, but he tried to force a play to Tyler Ennis that he probably shouldn't have. And then, you know, his really bad line change on the Patrick Kane second goal that turned out to be the backbreaker.
Where are we on Zach Parise watch?
Well, that's, although I didn't see him actually in Chicago, and I think, I didn't see Dudnik. I think they're both coming to Florida just to kind of be with the team, practice there. It is the father/mentor's trip for the team. But as far as Zach has told me, he is not playing. He's not playing. In fact, I overheard him telling his son in the locker room the other day that he wasn't playing on this trip. So
that's where you get all the information, isn't it? You talk to the toddler.
I said, "Can I write it?" He goes, "Yeah." The son asked him where his equipment was, and he goes, "It's in the truck." Remember, I told you I'm going, but I'm not playing. So I thought that was good. I thought that was good intel.
If you ever want honesty out of a team, you ask the toddlers. They will not lie to you.
Yeah, you know, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, so I think that Zach's going to, you know, come, I would think some point, maybe later this calendar year or early into next year. He still hasn't taken hits, but as far as I could tell, he's progressing, and it'd be a huge boost to get him back, just to deepen the lineup as well and get him back into the lineup and maybe create three quality scoring lines.
There's a lot of issues with this team compared to last year's team, but they have to like the fact that they have a backup goalie they can depend on. Stalock's been pretty solid.
And they're, you know, again, last night, I mean, you know, that thing could have been just disastrous if it wasn't for him keeping them in it. I just cannot believe still that he only gave up the one goal in the second period when, you know, 22 shots and grade A's all over the place. And he's just, he you know, to quote Bruce, he competes his butt off, and he's been terrific. And you know, luckily, you know, Dubnyk's not out long, but the good news is that when you have a guy like Stalock, you could just see the confidence that everybody has when he's in net.
Is he going to play every game now here coming up, or was it McCulloch's up right now?
Yeah. I think Dubnyk would have loved to have played maybe in Tampa. I still think that's pushing it. I just don't see how he plays that quick. But maybe, you know, that's your typical back-to-back. I think it would be really difficult throwing McCulloch to the Wolves against the Lightning. I mean, man, that team is sensational. That Stamkos, Kucherov, Nemestikov line. Just absolutely ridiculously good. They have 6 regulation losses all year. So, I mean, if there's a way that that Michalik's going to play, you'd think it would be in the Florida portion of that and play Stalock in Tampa. But we'll see. I mean, a lot of it depends on the game in Ottawa. They're playing a minor league team tomorrow. They've got that might be a little hyperbole when you have a team with Erik Karlsson on it, but that team has been a disaster. Maybe they got it back on track with the outdoor game they won the other day, but before that they lost 10 of 11. They've just been, and they're getting killed every single night. There's no excuse. The Wild have had 2 really damaging losses the last couple games against Edmonton and Chicago. They've got to get back on track tomorrow night.
We're interested if they want to send Carlson to Minnesota. Just let them know that.
Yeah. That's an unbelievable story. I mean, can you imagine if all of a sudden Ottawa's going to really be looking to trade Erik Karlsson? I would think a lot of teams would be lining up.
And then Doughty might be on the market this summer, right? I mean, the two of them,
I mean, they both are two years from UFA, so two summers from UFA.
Okay.
Really basing each other on them. You know, they're using each other as comparables. Doughty openly said that they're going to be talking.
Sure.
And, you know, in a league where the cap is going to go up by, you know, potentially $5 million next year, I mean, one's got to think that a guy like Erik Karlsson is going to be a $10 million defenseman. And there's not a ton of teams that can afford that. But, man, he's worth it.
All right. Thanks for help. And we'll view more of your stuff on The Athletic and theathletic.com.
Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you. Michael Russo from The Athletic. Minnesota Wild back in action tomorrow night. They take on the Ottawa Senators. 6 o'clock start. You'll hear that game right here on The Fan. And Wild Fan Line with myself and Pat Micheletti returns tomorrow night after the game. Mike Zimmer press conference is next.
It's the interim producer filling in as the interim host. You're listening to Brandon Molesky on The Fan. And...
register to win a pair of tickets to WWE Live Road to WrestleMania on March 9th at the Target Center. You can enter to win now at KFAN.com. Make the keyword contest.
All right, 1 hour to go. Brandon Molesky and Ryan Donaldson will run for the Common Man Dan Cole. And we'll be in all week. Common Man off. We won't see him until... after Christmas, next Tuesday. As we are awaiting the Mike Zimmer press conference, which he always does every Monday, typically at 2 o'clock, especially after noon games. It's always at 2 o'clock the day after a Vikings game. And it's always brought to you by Youngsteads. I do want to mention that I think there's a team in the NFC, right? You have your top six, and you have all the teams in the hunt. And I think there's a team that is not being talked about enough. Oh, let's go to the Mike Zimmer press conference. We'll get to that later.
Actually, we played very well. We flew around the ball. We were in the right place for the most part. Had a couple mistakes here and there. I think the crowd helped us a lot defensively. And then offensively, I thought we shot ourselves in the foot a little bit with some of the penalties that we had. It kind of set us back in some of the things. But, you know, some of it we overcame. Case, whatever it was, 20 out of 23 or whatever. I thought he did some very good things taking care of the ball and, it helped get some good runs in there, some efficient runs. And then special teams, I thought we did a good job as well. So, question. What do you think were some of the factors? You know, it was holding, grab guys. For the most part, it was stuff like that. You know, guys would start to come off a block and we'd grab them. Well, they were like they'd been like that in the past a little bit, so we kind of knew that if we got lined up quickly and got on the ball, we might catch them a few times.
When Delvin Cook got hurt, you said you were concerned about being pretty explosive plays that you're in the top 10 of the league or 20 yard plays. What's kind of been your key for that?
I think we've done a nice job of keeping teams off balance with with some of the play actions and some of the running game, and then. We've had the opportunity to hit some shots when we've been able to, but I think it's the combination of keeping people off balance a little bit.
Mike, you talk about your defense playing well, and they finally turned into points yesterday with Erik Hendricks. He says he wants to do more of that. Are you surprised they hadn't done that until this point, considering how great you've been playing?
We've had some chances that we haven't come all the way through, but I think when you score on defense or special teams, it elevates your chance to win games, and this year we just haven't had any like that yet. So, but it was good to see Erik made a great play, and he got some nice blocks down the sideline there, so it was good.
Mike,
A couple weeks ago, you were calling on the special teams to bounce back. Now that they have, is there a certain area that you've seen stand out more than the others?
You know, all the areas are doing much better, I think, now. You know, we could still probably be better on kickoff return, but we've been careful about the ones we take out. But other than that, I think they've done a lot better. I think Marcus has been a lot more aggressive, and that's added to field position. I think our coverage units have been better, and you know, I can't remember we got them inside the 23 or 4 times yesterday.
Mike, can you talk about Jared's role expanding in the passing game over the last few seasons?
Yeah, honestly, I don't think it's expanded any. He's always had a big role in the passing game. You know, he's always been a good third down guy, and you know, we just happened to catch him yesterday on a couple things that they messed up. You know, honestly, it was the same play both times. And one time they're in zone defense and they didn't play it correctly, and one time they're in man coverage and they ran into each other. So, you know, he was pretty open.
Like, how open he was given kind of that first play and it kind of manifested itself?
I don't know. I mean, you know, they had a couple new guys in there, so maybe that had something to do with it, but I don't know.
You're not a big fan of individual honors, but Pro Bowl selections will be announced tomorrow. Do you feel the Vikings are deserving to have a number of players named to the Pro Bowl?
I really only care about what the team does, honestly. You know, if they get voted in, great. If they don't, then that's just the way it goes. But, you know, this team has always been about teamwork and team cohesiveness. And, you know, I know all the guys are saying the same thing. It's not about an individual. It's about the team. And that's what I really like about this team.
Like, the teams that you've been on that have had first-round buys, what is the biggest thing that does for a team if they compare to a playoff push?
It's been a long time for that, you know, since it's happened. So, you know, honestly, we're not focused on that. We're focused on Green Bay and trying to figure out how we can win another game. You know, and be a good rival. It's a great rivalry, and you know, they're an excellent football team, a great organization, and you know, we'll have to play really good to win. So, you know, if we don't win this game and the next game, it really doesn't matter about all that stuff.
It remains to be seen if Aaron Rodgers will play depending on their playoff status. Linville Joseph said earlier today he definitely wants Rodgers to play because it'd be more of a challenge. Are you hoping that Rodgers will in fact be out there?
It's not up to me. We just play whoever comes out. Doesn't matter to me who plays.
How much of it all is that impact in the game planning process from being out?
Well, we'll assume that, you know, we'll prepare for both, and we'll assume that Rodgers is going to play. But I don't, you know, I mean, you know, it's no different than any other week where you don't know what's going on. And you guys wonder why I never say who the quarterback is, see?
Your offense seemed to evolve, though, with Hundley over the time that he was playing. Now he went back to the Rodgers offense. I guess we get this.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, you know, they're still doing a lot of the same things. I mean, I've only watched 3 games on him, you know, since before I came down here. But I mean, some of the stuff is, you know, the same, and then there's some other things you just have to. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to get into the differences and the, you know, those things. I mean, Rodgers is an unbelievable great player, right? So, I mean, he's hard to, you know, when somebody goes in, he's hard to replace. But you know, they have a lot of similarities, other than how great Rodgers is.
Looks like it could be about zero on Saturday night when you guys are playing. Does that put more emphasis on the run game and establish?
It could, but, you know, that's more about, I think that'll be determined more about the wind and things like that. you know, field conditions, a lot of those things will come into factor. I mean, you can throw the ball in the cold. It's just, you know, sometimes wind and crosswinds and things like that affect it a little bit more, so. It may be a different, you know, and it's like everything else. You go in a game and, you know, you prepare for these things, and then as you get there, it's, you know, you might have to change some of the combination routes you're running because of the wind, or you might have to change some of the defenses you're playing because of the conditions that you're playing in. It's just, you know, it's part of adjusting during the game, no different than if this guy's killing you catching balls. Okay, well, now we got to double this guy, or we got to do this or do that. You know, it's just all part of the game management, part of adjusting. You know, yesterday wasn't too bad. You know, I think we're it's probably the most efficient runs that we've had this year. You know, that's a good defensive front that they had in there, and you know, they're doing a lot of pressure and coming off the edge. I think you know, we've had some explosive runs, and that's, you know, that's kind of it. You know, if team is trying to pressure some, you know, and you catch them the right way. You know, they catch you sometimes, you catch them sometimes. But when you catch them, it's a big play. And I think that happened the other day.
Mike, Anthony Barr says he's having a better season, and one of the reasons is he's more focused and more engaged than ever since the play. Would you agree that that's the reason why?
I don't know the reason. I know he's having a great year. He's playing really good. He's been very active. You know, he's on top of things. He makes a lot of checks for the defense and things going on the field. He's been physical, very active in really in all phases of the game.
Is there a noticeable difference for you getting Elfline back and just what he can bring, both from diagnosing and maybe even getting downfield and making some blocks down there?
Yeah, I don't think it was so much the diagnosing. But, you know, he's a good center, and I think some of that showed up, yeah.
Mike, when you wrap up the division with two games to go, what, if anything, can you do to make sure that players don't in any way let their guard down?
Well, I think that our players kind of understand from 2 weeks ago that this thing happens really fast if something goes haywire. And that's number one. And number two, actually, I got three. Number two, our guys are pretty smart, focused guys, and I think they understand what's at stake. And number three, we're still playing for seeding. So, you know, we would like to play, if possible, we'd like to play every game in U.S. Bank Stadium. So, you know, I know we're going to get one, but we're kind of greedy. Good. Thanks.
I love that. Playing one, but we're getting greedy.
I love that.
I love it.
Best ever.
As I was mentioning before Zimmer came on, there's one team in the NFC that I feel like people are just dismissing as a team that can make the postseason. Right? You've got your top six. You got Philly, Minnesota, L.A., New Orleans, Carolina. Atlanta's kind of in the sixth spot, but on the border. Everyone's been talking about the Packers with Aaron Rodgers returning. They've been talking about Seattle. They've been talking about Dallas. It seems like nobody is mentioning the Detroit Lions. And here they are after a win over Chicago on Saturday. They're at 8-6. If Atlanta loses tonight at Tampa Bay, which I don't expect them to, I would think the Falcons win that game. But if they are, then now you have a bunch of teams tied at 8-6. You'd have Atlanta at 8-6. You'd have Seattle 8-6. Dallas 8-6. Detroit 8-6. Green Bay now down at 7-7. Detroit has the easiest schedule the rest of the way. Now, their tiebreakers are not very favorable because they lost to New Orleans, they lost to Carolina, and they lost to Atlanta. So if you were to tie any of those teams, which at this point, the best you could do against New Orleans or Carolina would tie them, so Detroit can only really get the sixth seed because they lose the tiebreakers to all those teams. The tiebreakers, in terms of individual matchups, are not in their favor. But I can say, out of all the teams that are fighting for that last playoff spot, Detroit's got the easiest way to go, and Detroit's winning their last two. Detroit goes to Cincinnati this weekend. We saw how the Bengals were. They've now pretty much quit 2 weeks in a row. They got destroyed by Chicago and destroyed by Minnesota. I don't expect them to put up much of a fight next week. Detroit gets 9-6. Then they get the Packers at home. By then, Packers are going to be officially eliminated. They might be eliminated by this week. Is Aaron Rodgers even going to play? If he does play, I still think that Detroit's got a decent shot at home. The rest of the way, the Lions have the easiest schedule. The Lions are going 10-6. Is that good enough to get in? Who knows? But Atlanta, after they get Tampa Bay tonight, they've got two very difficult games. They got to go to New Orleans, who's still playing for something, and then they host Carolina, who's still playing for something. They could easily lose those two games. Seattle's got to go to Dallas this week, so one of those teams is losing next week. They're gonna, whoever loses that game is going to be out of it. And even Dallas has to go to Philadelphia week 17, which they're fighting for a number one seed. I do think, though, I guess if Philadelphia just wins one of the two games, they're the number one seed, correct?
Yeah, because they've got the tiebreaker over the Vikes.
They clinched the home, the first round bye for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So if Philadelphia wins this week, then I guess they could just kind of mail it in week 17. But who knows? But that could be a very difficult game for Dallas. So Dallas got two potentially difficult games. Seattle's got to go to Dallas, which gets Ezekiel Elliott back this week. And Atlanta's got two difficult games. Detroit's got a shot at making the playoffs, and nobody's even talking about
it. No one's mentioned them.
Because they're going 10-6.
Yeah, I'm with you.
You heard it here first. The Minnesota Twins apparently are interested in a top-flight free agent. I do want to talk about Wolves as well. Brandon Molesky in for Common.
It's Tenna B in for Common on The Fan.
Brandon Molesky, 10 to B. Ryan Donaldson, coming out. He's gone all week. And I see this story from Lavelle E'Neal from the Star Tribune about a half hour ago. And there's a picture of Yu Darvish online at StarTribune.com. On the front of the story, it says, Twins are still part of the Yu Darvish sweepstakes.
Oh, my gosh. Above average at that.
He talks about how general manager Thad Levine called Darvish, quote, a priority. Manager Paul Molitor at the winter meetings on Wednesday in Florida said the Twins have, quote, tremendous interest in him. And Lavelle writes, the Twins might be serious this time. Apparently there was a report out of a Japanese sports website that mentioned the Cubs as the leading candidate for Darvish, but that the Twins and the Astros are also showing strong interest. Obviously, Darvish and Jake Arrieta are kind of the two top arms on the market. Then you get some second-tier arms behind them. But the Twins last week signed Michael Pineda, though don't think he's going to be available this year. He's more of a shot at 2019 coming off that Tommy John surgery. They also signed, was it Friday they signed? I was out. They signed Fernando Rodney.
Yes.
Well, he's 40 years old now?
Yes, he is. He had 39 saves last year, though.
Isn't it amazing to see a 40-year-old with a hat cocked to the side? Like, that's just not really... That's more like your generation, not my generation.
Well, Torrey Hunter started it, kind of, yeah. in baseball. Yeah, he's got to be in his 40s now. I bet he still wears the hat sideways a little bit.
So, I mean, there's always risk when you sign a 40-year-old, but you sign him for $4.5 million. If he doesn't work out, it's just money. Who cares? And he can still throw the heat. He's apparently still getting up to 96 miles per hour last year. And after a really bad start, his numbers overall don't look that great, but it's because he got off to an awful start. And from after the first month or the first 2 months, the rest of the year, he was pretty darn good again. So it sounds like he'll be the closer and at least give you some help for the bullpen. The part I found the most interesting about Lavelle's story regarding the closer spot is... Lavelle writes, former Twin Brandon Kinstler was willing to return as the closer, but the Twins surprisingly never offered him a contract. Kinstler received a 2-year deal from the Nationals. Do you know how much he got for his 2 years?
I don't, unfortunately. I could probably find it pretty quick.
I would find it odd. I mean, if you wanted Fernando Rodney as your closer over Brandon Kinstler, understandable. I don't think Kinstler was ever supposed to be the long-term solution at that spot. I think he was just temporary because he didn't have anyone else, and he pitched pretty well for you last year, but... To me, I just want arms. I just want bullpen guys. I don't care if they're closers, setup men, the long innings guy. I don't care. Just get as many good relievers in there as possible. So if there would have been a way to sign both and he wanted to come here, I would have done that. But if Kinstler was, hey, I only want to be a closer and I got to make closer money, then understandable you would go in a different direction. But I'll be interested to see if the Twins throw some money towards Yu Darvish. As of right now, it sounds like a contract has not been offered, which I find bizarre. Maybe I just don't understand baseball enough.
It's confusing.
Why did free agency start like a month and a half ago?
Yeah.
And we just sit here and we just wait for like the big names to be taken down. What's taking so long and how have you not offered him a contract?
It's funny because it's completely different in other sports. Like in the NBA and NFL, you have like the 3-day window.
First day, NHL,
like,
you do it too.
NHL, like 12:01, or, you know, at midnight that night, you've got like six different stars that have already signed their 6 years, triple-digit, million-dollar deals. And by the way, Kintzler did sign for $10 million on...
10 for 2 years.
10 for 2 years.
So, not too much different other than just a guaranteed more year than what Fernando Rodney got. But, yeah, if... Lavelle writes, how the Twins react when, if Darvish asked for 6 years and $140 million, $150 million, which would easily be a club record for a free agent, will be the test to their willingness to dive into the deep waters of free agency to add top talent. Here's, the Twins can finally prove something to us and send a message to the fan base and the media that you don't spend enough money. We have a limit to what we can spend. Show us. Right, it's easy to say that. It's easy to say, no, our GM is not limited with payroll. We don't put a salary cap on him. You've been saying that for years. Now show us that you want to spend some money. And I know there's a lot of people right now, they're going, Darvish was awful in the World Series. He was awful in the postseason. It's probably the only reason we're in the mix for him. I'm sure his dollar amount probably went down a little bit into a range we could actually get. And I know Darvish isn't elite of the elite pitchers out there. But I tell you, Darvish, Santana, and I can't expect Santana to have the same performance he did last year. He was pretty good last year. I would expect for him to come back a little bit to the pack. But still, I've always thought of Santana as a number one, not an elite number one, but maybe, you know, bottom half of the league number one. Barrios definitely has potential maybe to be a one. But you throw Darvish in there, who is a one. You got a Darvish as a one. You got a Santana now as your two. Or you could have an argument who's the one. But at the very least, you get two guys that both could be your one or two. And Barrios is a three who's got potential to be even better. You've got three guys now that every time they're pitching, you think you've got a pretty good shot to win. Three out of five.
That's a good rotation
and,
right there.
And, you know, your bottom guys that we've had, the four or five guys, the Kyle Gibsons of the world, you're now slotting them down in the rotation. So we're not asking Kyle Gibson to be a two or a three. We just want you to put up four or five numbers. And if you can emerge and give us three numbers as our four or five, at this point, I don't even know who we have in our rotation. I guess Phil Hughes, technically, could he be now available after injury? Is he still out for next year?
Yeah, I don't think he's been updated as far as his injury goes. I don't know if I'm comfortable counting on him. But
I won't count on him.
You can count his name in the mix for sure.
Yeah. Who else do we have?
Oh, gosh, off the top of my head.
It's amazing how, like, 2 months removed from the season, you forget everything.
Hector Santiago, I don't know what his contract is, though.
I think we still have him.
I think so, too.
But Santiago's a good example of, and he's been hurt.
Yeah.
But if he's your five, I'll take him as my five.
No doubt.
Right?
It's the trickle-down effect.
Do I want him as my two and three? No.
No.
But if he's my five in my retirement, that's fine.
You can get away with that.
He's competent. He's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how just adding one guy like that can kind of slot everyone down into their correct and proper slots and being in the positions they're supposed to be in.
Yeah, it's one man, but it's the trickle-down effect. It makes the rest of your rotation that much better and deeper, for that matter. So, yeah, it would be a huge, huge signing if they could land Darvish.
Quickly on the Wolves, they're playing for the Northwest Division lead tonight. They get the Portland Trail Blazers, 7 o'clock. Wolves currently a half game ahead of Portland, so Portland could leapfrog them for the lead in the division. Should we be worried about the Butler back spasms at all? He ended up playing through it the other night in the loss to Phoenix.
I'm a little worried about it. I mean, in this town, too, I mean, how many times have we seen little issues like back problems or bilateral weakness? Parisi, exactly the name that came to my mind. You know, that kind of turns into something bigger, and backs are very problematic. I know from experience, I have a terrible back. And they're very, very troublesome. When you have a bad back and you throw out your back, you're basically helpless.
They linger forever, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and you're...
And they can come back at any moment.
Right, it can strike back up at any moment, exactly. And the way that Tibbs has kind of been playing these guys 40 minutes every night, I mean, a lot of people are going to say, see, I told you so, I have a feeling.
He's Ryan Donaldson, I'm Brandon Molesky. A little NFL roundup, we're going through all the games next.
You're listening to Tana B.
If I'm not back in 5 minutes... Just wait longer.
Filling in for the common man on the Fan.
All right, Brandon Molesky, Ryan Donaldson, one final segment before Dan Barrero takes over at 3 o'clock. One Twins rotation name that I forgot. Adalberto Mejia.
Oh, how could you forget?
Mejia.
We go with Mejia.
He was all right.
Yeah, he had
solid
moments.
And like I said, as a 4 or 5, I'd be happy with him. Trevor May's name also thrown out, though. Wasn't he more kind of a bullpen guy? I know initially he was a starter. They were contemplating moving him back to the rotation. But now if we get Yu Darvish, we don't have any room in the rotation for Trevor May. But then you put him in the bullpen, hopefully your bullpen gets stronger. So
the trickle-down effect. It works in every way.
Let's start with the game of the week, maybe the game of the year in Pittsburgh.
Third and goal to go from the 6. Roethlisberger under center, drops back, he pumps, he throws to the middle. It's back incomplete, intercepted by Harmon. Deflection to Harmon, an interception in the end zone. The Patriots are going to win in Pittsburgh.
I mean, I don't know what to say anymore. I really don't.
First down at the 20-yard line.
The Patriots will have a touchback and line up in victory formation after their string of comebacks.
Bob Sochi, who apparently was also the Micro Machines guy back in the day, and Scott Zolak on the 98.5 Sports Hub Patriots Radio Network as the Patriots take down the Pittsburgh Steelers 27-24. Tom Brady, not his best afternoon, 22 of 35 for 298, also threw an interception. Rob Gronkowski was unbelievable. 9 catches, 168 yards, including just absolutely destroying Pittsburgh, who for some reason was just single covering him the entire final drive. 3 pretty good catches. The third one, even though it was the shortest game, might have been the most unbelievable of all. Pretty much a shoestring catch for a guy that size to be that flexible was unbelievable. But the New England Patriots now controlling their own destiny. And how about the drama in this game, Ryan? You go from, you know, New England stopping Pittsburgh with 2 minutes left. They drive down. They score, give too much time for Ben. They got the two-point conversion as well to Gronk. I forgot about that.
Yep.
To make it a three-point game. So you think, Pittsburgh, they still got some time left, but they're in trouble. I don't even know what their timeout situation was, but I know they didn't have a lot, if any. They get the, was that the Juju Smith-Schuster who had the big play, the 65-yard gain or whatever?
Where he stayed in bounds, cut it back in the
unbelievable
midfield.
Play.
Unreal.
They end up scoring on the next play, or at least we thought they scored, a Jesse James. It was a catch. According to the new rules, it's not a catch when you catch the ball and actually lean your hand over the goal line, and then the ball shifts a little bit in your hands when you hit the ground. Not a catch. Big Ben throws an interception on the next play, so even though they're down 3, could have gotten the chip shot field goal and sent it to overtime. They lose with the number 1 seed on the line. It looks like everyone's going to have to go through New England in the AFC. The other controversial call of the night happened last night in Oakland.
Carr leaning in on his right foot, gets the shotgun snap. Sets, pressure coming. Carr in some trouble. Eludes the rush. Carr pumps. Carr on the run. Carr to the 5, diving for the pylon up the right sideline, and he is out of bounds. The ball popped out.
Is this going to be a touchback?
Is it a touchback? The ball came out. Did it go through the end zone for a touchback? If it did, the game will be over.
Through the end zone and out of the end zone.
Touchback.
The ruling on the field is a touchback. First down, Dallas.
Unbelievable. Carr fumbling the ball through the end zone for a touchback, and the Cowboys are going to win it 20-17. They can run out the clock.
Yes, Derek Carr with the Oakland Raiders down 3 points on third and goal from about the 3 or the 4. Goes towards the pylon, goes to reach out for it as he's near the sideline, loses the ball about a half yard or a yard before he gets to it. The thing goes through the end zone, which, of course, is a touchback. The Dallas Cowboys hold on. They stay alive in the playoff race for now. They beat the Oakland Raiders 20-17. And, Ryan, I don't know what you feel about it. I've always thought that rule is kind of a weird rule.
I don't like it.
It's one thing if you're going to change possession, but then to say, hey, you can have the 20-yard line. Get the ball at the 20-yard line, as opposed to, hey, the fumble happened at the 1 or the half-yard line. Shouldn't they just get the ball there where they fumbled it? Why do you, like, gain 20 yards out of it? That's always seems kind of bizarre, and that's happened a couple times this year. That happened in the what, the Chicago, is that the Chicago-Green Bay game or the Chicago-Detroit game? It was in Chicago.
Yeah.
Might have been the Green Bay game.
There was also a Rams game where it happened, because I know Todd Gurley did the same thing.
Yeah. I think the rule's a little weird. To me, it's just, well, you fumbled the ball and you should get the ball. It should have been fourth and goal from the 1 yard line.
Yeah, I don't like the rule at all. I mean, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, like, I don't understand why the rule is written the way it is, because when you fumble the ball, let's just pretend like the ball went out at the 2 or at the 1 or whatever, the 50 yard line, right? I mean, it still sticks with the Raiders. You can't, there is no turnover there. If the ball gets fumbled out of bounds, it sticks with the team. Yeah. I understand that if it goes through the end zone, just by default, it's got to be a touchback. Because it's technically the end zone, and if a ball goes out of bounds in the end zone, it's a touchback.
Yeah.
I just don't like the rule, though, because it's such a huge swing where, like, it's not like the defense really does anything to deserve the turnover.
Well, I mean, they do. I mean, they're stopping you from getting to the end zone.
Yeah, but I still think that there should just be, like, the ball should be placed where the guy lost it, or something.
If that exact play happened on any other part of the field, it goes out of bounds, and they maintain possession. And like I said, it's almost like the NBA where 5 seconds left in the game, and you call a timeout, then all of a sudden you get to throw the ball, and you get the inbounds, the pass from half court. It's like, how did you just gain this magical amount of feet in the court? That makes no sense.
Yeah.
And the same thing, if you're going to make the rule that's a change of possession, why do they get 20 yards out of it?
Yeah, if that's the case, bizarre. I'm with you. Put it at the 1 yard line or something if you have to give it to the other team.
Dramatic finish in the Meadowlands yesterday afternoon. Thought the Vikings might have the number one seed after yesterday, but unfortunately, Eli couldn't get it done.
The Giants are either going to take the lead or lose the game on this play. Manning lines them up again. Can the Eagles stop the Giants right here? Manning takes the snap. He's back. He's looking. He is firing, and it is incomplete. It is out of the end zone. Incomplete. Intended for Engram. With 43 seconds to go.
And that's a wrap, boys and girls.
The Giants have 3 timeouts, Mike, so it's a little short of a wrap.
Merrill Reese and Mike Quick. Reese, pretty sharp on that one. With Sports Radio 94 WIP, Eagles hold on over the New York Giants. They were once down, 20-7 in that game. They win 34-29, so the Eagles just need one win in their last two to get to clinch the number one seed in the NFC. Nick Foles with 4 touchdown passes for Philadelphia, replacing Carson Wentz. And it's always amazing how a missed extra point or a blocked extra point can come back to bite you later on in the game. Philadelphia won that game by 5 points. The Giants had an extra point blocked after their first touchdown, right? So instead of being up 7-0, they were up 6-0. Well, what happened is because they missed that extra point, later in the game on the Giants' last touchdown, they had to go for 2 to get themselves within 3. They missed that 2-point conversion, so now all of a sudden they're down 5. If they would have hit the initial extra point, assuming you're going to hit the next extra point, you're down 3, and on fourth down there, you're kicking a field goal to send it to overtime as opposed to being forced to go for it on fourth down to try to get the touchdown. One little blocked kick changed the landscape of that entire game and maybe the landscape of the NFC.
Yeah, could be. I mean, they're more than likely going to wrap up the number one seed. I don't know if they're going to be hosting the NFC Championship games. I don't know if Nick Foles and the Eagles are going to be able to make it that far. So I'm not too worried about it as a Vikings fan. I think we'll be here at US Bank.
Philadelphia hosts Oakland next weekend and then hosts Dallas, in week 17. LA Rams looked pretty impressive yesterday.
Trips right formation. Goff comes under center to put his hands to his head and bark out a command. Now he backs up into the gun. Silent count has the snap. Scrambles to his right and throws. Gurley in the flat. Gurley at the 10. Gurley goes in. His 4th touchdown of the day. 3 on the ground and now 1 through the air. Sean McVay celebrates. Gurley going off in Seattle.
J.B. Long, ESPN LA 710. Absolute domination. Did you ever think a Rams team would win 42-7 at Seattle?
In Seattle.
Going into this season, did you predict that to happen?
Never would have seen that coming. Unbelievable.
Todd Gurley, 4 touchdowns, 3 of them runs, 1 via the pass. He had 21 carries for 152 yards, 3 catches for 28 yards. I'm guessing he won a lot of semifinal games for fantasy football owners single-handedly yesterday. Would have been nice to have Todd Gurley on your roster. But the Rams, now 10-4. Basically going to win that division. Now, I know Seattle's 8-6. I guess it's possible. Because Seattle won that first meeting between those two, right? So it's not like the Rams. I don't know the tiebreakers between the Rams and Seattle, but it looks like the Rams will win the NFC West and at the very least have a home playoff round in the divisional round. I guess it's maybe possible they could still sneak up and get that number two seed from the Vikings if everything works out right. But for anyone that doubted the Rams through the first 7-8 weeks of the season, I don't think you can doubt them any now. They've been looking pretty good with what wins over New Orleans and Seattle in recent weeks.
Yeah. They're really good. I mean, they're definitely one of the teams to be reckoned with in the postseason.
And they're pretty balanced.
They are.
They've got a darn good defense and a good running attack, and Jared Goff has done enough offensively to give them a pretty good offense throughout the entire season. We already played this highlight earlier, but why not play it again?
Rodgers back, pocket collapsing. Rodgers steps up, looking down the field, throws deep down the field for Jordy Nelson, and it is intercepted again by Carolina. James Bradbury comes down with this one at the Green Bay 26, the third interception thrown by Rodgers today. And the Panthers, with a 10-point lead, will take over.
Westwood One on the call, Ryan Radke, Derek Rackley, as the Packers lose to the Panthers 31-24. Green Bay can be done from the postseason if Atlanta wins tonight in Tampa Bay. And Carolina, for the second consecutive week, almost blew a double-digit lead there at the end. Green Bay had possession on the final drive before Geronimo Allison fumbles. Geronimo Allison might not have even been getting that catch if Devontae Adams hadn't been knocked out of the game with a concussion on a pretty severe illegal hit that should be punishable.
And some breaking news regarding that hit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Thomas Davis has been suspended for 2 games by the NFL for that very hit.
You got to start suspending multiple games on these guys.
You certainly do. He will obviously appeal the suspension, according to Adam Schefter. But yeah, Thomas Davis suspended 2 games for that hit on Devontae.
The fines aren't going to work. You got to start suspending because that takes money away from them as well.
Correct.
Rodgers, by the way, 26 of 45 through those 3 interceptions, threw for 290 yards. Did have 3 touchdowns as well. But the stat that sticks out to me, Aaron Rodgers' 45 pass attempts, which is not odd for an Aaron Rodgers-led team. That being said, when Rodgers was out, Green Bay's running game was starting to emerge a little bit. It was a little bit, you know, by committee, and they had some injuries as well. They didn't really have a set guy all the time. But when Huntley was in, they were running the ball and running it relatively effectively, at least more effectively than they have in the past. And it's not like they were being blown out or were, you know, I think at the most they were down 7 in that game yesterday. Well, I guess they were down 2 scores there in the fourth quarter. But up until that point, why they're abandoning the run, why not have a good balanced offense just because you've got arguably the best quarterback in the league makes little sense to me.
How many Minnesota Vikings fans were holding their breath when the Packers got that onside kick?
Well, I mean, it was one of those games where you kind of wanted Carolina to lose too, right?
Because, true, it would have helped us a little,
you know,
with the seeding.
Now, if Rodgers ends up not playing this week because they're out of it, then ultimately that would have been the best route for the Vikings to go because it really ensures that you're going to win in Green Bay. If Rodgers plays this week, that's a dicey game all of a sudden, right? If Rodgers doesn't, you're winning your last two, and you're not worried about your record taking a hit, and you're going to get a top two seed. That being said, if the Vikings were to fall at all, Carolina is really the only team that can take that number two seed away from them, just because of the head-to-head victory we had last week. So, a part of you could have been cheering for the Packers to win, but if Rodgers ends up not playing this week, then I think ultimately that's what's best for the Minnesota Vikings. And I will admit my teeth were chattering at the thought of Green Bay coming in here in the NFC Championship game with Aaron Rodgers and facing us.
Me and you both.
Jacksonville did their best L.A. Rams impression.
Westbrook to the left, the other two to the right. Yeldon, the running back, at the shotgun. He dropped the throw to Blake. Blake looks, fires toward the goal line. Caught by Jadon Mickens into the end zone. Touchdown! How many does this guy plan on scoring?
Yeah, the Jaguars radio network, Frank Frangie, along with Jeff Loggeman and Tony Baselli, as the Jacksonville Jaguars rout the Houston Texans 45-7. They were up 31-0 at half there. Blake Bortles, 3 touchdowns for Jacksonville. And the Jaguars back in the playoffs for the first time since 2007. Remember the drama they had in the preseason? Right, they were contemplating a quarterback change about halfway through the preseason. They said Blake Bortles isn't doing it for us. Is Chad Henne their backup?
Yes.
Is he still their backup? I think Henne might have gotten a start in a preseason game. And to see where they've come from with that quarterback situation, Leonard Fournette had an issue where he was just, you know, sat out a game, and then he's been hurt when really he was the sole offense for the first half of the season. Defense has been good the whole time, but pretty impressive that Jacksonville, given everything that happened before the season, and then, well, I even remember I was watching Hard Knocks on HBO, and it was focused on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. But the Buccaneers were scrimmaging the Jacksonville Jaguars, right? They were doing their own little scrimmage. And I remember one of the Buccaneers defensive linemen, it might have been McCoy, might have been someone else, was just mocking the Jaguars fans, just going, you guys are really fans of one of the worst franchises in the National Football League, and you guys never have a shot. And by watching Hard Knocks, they made it seem like Tampa Bay was just killing them in the preseason. Like they were playing the Cleveland Browns of the National Football League. And to have all that happen, and to see where Jacksonville is now, a team that has clinched a playoff spot, and still technically could get a top two seed in the AFC, is pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, Jalen Ramsey and A.J. Bouye out there in Jacksonville are some of the best corners in the NFL, and they both happen to play on the same defense. And they also lost Allen Robinson earlier in the season, their number one wide receiver, and Bortles has stuck through it. So, yeah, you got to give them some kudos.
The New Orleans Saints had a dicey one versus the New York Jets yesterday.
Ingram gets the call. Right side, and there he goes. Inside the 35, 30, 25, 20, 15, 10, 5 to the goal line.
That's a touchdown.
Touchdown, Saints.
That helps the average a little bit there. Outstanding job. It's just power. Power, and Mark sees it. He's able to hit it. The safeties take a bad angle, and that'll do it.
50-yard touchdown ramble by Ingram, who's gone over 1,000 yards on the season for the second straight campaign.
That's Jim Henderson and Deuce McAllister of the WWL Radio, the flagship station for the New Orleans Saints. Saints win 31-19 over the New York Jets. The Jets had scored with 1:51 left in the fourth quarter to get themselves within distance. They don't get the onside kick. Ingram then gets that rushing touchdown for 50 yards. He had two touchdowns, one of one, one of 50. 12 carries, 74 yards rushing. He also had five catches for 77 yards receiving. And I was just thinking, Ryan, the New Orleans Saints are going to have two running backs in the Pro Bowl, aren't they?
Yeah, they're both making it for sure.
Because other than Gurley, who else in the NFC would have a running back that would be ahead of both Kamara and Ingram?
Crickets. I'm not thinking of
right?
any. Yeah.
Seattle, no. Arizona, no. San Francisco, no. Carolina, no. Atlanta, no. Tampa Bay, no. Philadelphia, no. Ezekiel Elliott's been out for Dallas, so no. Mm-hmm. Washington, no. Giants, no. Vikings, no. Detroit, no. Packers, no. Chicago, Jordan Howard, but he's not on their level. So, heck, Latavius Murray might be like fifth in this discussion. You look at all the running backs in the NFC, Latavius Murray might be, if the Saints get to the Super Bowl and both those guys can't be in the Pro Bowl, Latavius Murray might actually get a Pro Bowl bid out of this.
Hey, now we're cooking. Now we got
maybe
something
Jared
going.
McKinnon.
Yeah, you could get
but
Jet there
just,
too.
Just interesting that two Saints running backs could both be in the Pro Bowl. San Francisco's hot.
This will be 45 for the win.
Got the walk-off win in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. Let's hope he can do it again here at home.
And as always, these essential parts of this team. Kyle Nelson, the snapper, and Bradley Pinion, the holder. From the left hash mark, 45 yards to win a third straight for the 49ers. Ball snapped. Kick is on the way by Robbie Gould, and it is good! Three straight for the 49ers.
Yeah, three straight wins. The 49ers are now 4-10 after being 1-10 at one point. Their victory over Tennessee, 25-23, after Tennessee had gotten a go-ahead field goal from 50 yards from Suckup with 1:07 to go. Jimmy Garoppolo marches them down the field. They get a 45-yarder from Gould. Garoppolo, 31 of 43 for 381 yards as the 49ers have won three straight. And when they traded for Garoppolo, I thought to myself, why are they doing this? They've got one win on the season. They're going to be one of the three worst teams. They're going to get one of those stud young quarterbacks. So why would you actually give up compensation for a Garoppolo when you could draft one of these stud rookie young quarterbacks next year? All Garoppolo has done is come in and been absolutely red hot, and that's why they're paid to make decisions in the National Football League, and I am not.
Apparently the Patriots also accepted less from San Francisco than a Browns offer for Jimmy Garoppolo.
They want him in the different conference.
So, yeah, Belichick
said,
hey,
of Cleveland.
Go on. You can go out to the West Coast, stay out of our, you know, AFC over here, and go have fun in San Francisco.
Maybe they're just doing Garoppolo a favor.
Well, that
like,
too.
Hey, you've been a good soldier. They want to
sabotage his career.
Yeah. Yeah, we want to be nice to you, so we're not going to send you to Cleveland.
That was nice of them.
Buffalo still in the playoff mix. They win 24-16 over Miami, and Washington took down Arizona 20-15. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate your help.
Hey, great job.
Gopher Basketball Weekly with Richard Pitino at noon tomorrow. Ryan and I will be back 1-3 right here on The Fan. Dan Barrow is next. Thanks for listening today. It's been a good day.
To listen back to a podcast of today's show, visit the Common Man channel on the iHeartRadio app or go to KFAN.com.